Good morning and welcome to day two of the Central Coast Regional Water Board meeting. I'd like to call this meeting to order. Can we get a roll call, please?
Vice Chair Rodriguez.
Here.
Member Wolf.
Here.
Member Hoskins.
Here.
Member Rock.
Here.
Member Bora.
Here.
And we have a quorum. The Executive Officer Lodge, will turn it over to you for introductions, if we have any.
Thank you, Vice Chair Rodriguez. Yes, good morning. My name is Ryan Lodge. I'm the Executive Officer at the Central Coast Water Board. Do some staff introductions this morning. To my far left at the table, we have our clerk to the board, Kai Johnson. To my right, we have our legal counsel from the Office of Chief Counsel at the State Water Resources Control Board, Sophie Froelich. To my immediate left, we have Assistant Executive Officer Angela Schroeder. And then this morning, we have Section Managers Tamara Anderson and Greg Bishop. Also like to recognize our audiovisual support from AGP in the back of the room and thank them for their help today. And that's it for introductions.
Moving on to item number 14, microplastics and water quality. Executive Officer Lodge, please.
Yes, thank you. So item 14 this morning, we have an informational item on microplastics and water quality. We have a group of speakers this morning that will all be participating via Zoom. Microplastics are an emerging pollutant and water quality issue, and they're essentially everywhere, as you will see. Today's speakers will touch on California's microplastics strategy and current research into microplastics and the impacts on the environment. Our speakers today include Kyla Kelly. She's a water quality program manager from the Ocean Protection Council. We have Andrew Hamilton, Assistant Deputy Director at the Office of Information and Management and Analysis from the State Water Resources Control Board. Dr. Wen Kauger, Executive Director from the Moore Institute. Dr. Andrew Gray, Associate Professor of Watershed Hydrology from the University of California in Riverside. And then also Dr. Scott Coffin, Staff Toxicologist Specialist from the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. So with that, I will turn it over to Kyla from the Ocean Protection Council for her presentation.
Thank you. Good morning. I currently don't have share capabilities, if someone can grant that for sharing my slides.
We'll work on that.
We can do that for you.
All right. Good morning, Chair and Board members. Thank you for having me today to speak about the statewide microplastic strategy. As introduced, I'm Kyla Kelly, and I'm the Water Quality Program Manager for the Ocean Protection Council. As a brief background, the Ocean Protection Council, or OPC, is a cabinet-level policy body within the California Natural Resources Agency. OPC's mission is to protect California's coast and ocean by advancing science-informed policy and management, making key strategic investments to fill critical information gaps in advanced state policies, and convening partners across the state. Our work largely falls under four priorities, including increasing resilience for the coast and ocean to climate change, advancing community-led projects and stewardship, enhancing biodiversity, and informing a sustainable blue economy. Now turning to plastics, we are all well aware that plastic pollution is pervasive, persistent, and only anticipated to grow as plastic production increases with significant impacts to marine life and marine ecosystems. Public concern regarding microplastic pollution led to the enactment of two state bills in 2018, Senate Bill 1263, directing the Ocean Protection Council to develop a statewide microplastic strategy, and Senate Bill 1422, requiring the testing and reporting of microplastics in drinking water by the State Water Resources Control Board. My presentation this morning is focused on Senate Bill 1263, the statewide microplastic strategy. As directed by the legislature, OPC developed the statewide microplastic strategy in coordination with specified state agencies, including the State Water Resources Control Board, and with input from the OPC Science Advisory Team's Microplastic Working Group. The strategy, adopted in 2022, serves as a roadmap to guide coordination across state action to reduce and better understand microplastic pollution in California. This June, OPC also released a report to the legislature summarizing the actions taken across the state to advance the strategy since 2022. To elaborate, the strategy outlines a two-track approach with immediate recommended actions to reduce plastic pollution while simultaneously advancing research to better understand and inform future actions to prevent microplastics from reaching California's marine environment. Overall, the strategy recognizes that plastic pollution is pervasive but preventable. Under the first track, the strategy focuses on three ways to reduce plastic pollution. First, eliminating plastic waste at the source by holding producers accountable for plastic pollution through alternative product design or materials. Second, preventing microplastics from reaching California waters by addressing pathways such as stormwater and wastewater, and through interventions like green infrastructure. And third, conducting outreach and education to influence public behavior and reduce reliance on single-use plastics. The second track focuses on research to advance our understanding of microplastics through an iterative process centered on monitoring. This monitoring is critical for informing risk thresholds for water quality assessments and other uses, such as fish advisories, supporting water quality impairment determinations, understanding which sources of plastics are affecting which communities and ecosystems, and ultimately identifying where public investment and additional actions or solutions may be needed. The state and OPC, among other external partners, including the federal government, have made significant investments and progress towards addressing the 22 recommended early actions and 13 research priorities identified in the strategy since its adoption in 2022. On the early action side, this includes investments in foundational microplastics research and standardized monitoring methods to better understand and prevent microplastic pollution in California waters. The inclusion of microplastics in water quality assessments for the first time ever in the Water Board's 2024 Clean Water Act Integrated Report. The enactment of the nation's most comprehensive single-use plastic packaging law, the Plastic Pollution Prevention and Packaging Producer Responsibility Act, or SB 54, in the summer of 2022, and the adoption of regulations by CalRecycle this spring. Importantly, the Senate Bill 54 sets clear targets to reduce plastic and increase the actual recyclability of plastic products sold in California by ensuring that these products are designed with materials that can actually be recycled and that the necessary recycling infrastructure is in place for these products. On the research side, OPC funded two targeted foundational projects informed and selected in coordination with the state water boards to study and quantify the ability of green infrastructure or low impact development best management practices, or BMPs, to effectively intervene with the flow of microplastics in stormwater. Together, these two studies demonstrated the effectiveness of low impact development BMPs for reducing microplastics in stormwater and identify design and site specific factors that influence BMP performance. The findings also provide recommendations to inform future design and maintenance, as well as information to help guide BMP siting that could inform future permit requirements or BMP guidance for permittees. OPC, in close partnership with the water boards, has also made key investments to advance plastic monitoring across the state, including a microplastic sample collection methods evaluation across four matrices, sediment, biota, stormwater, and ambient water, in order to harmonize methodology and improve comparability across studies. A monitoring framework to inform coordinated monitoring across the state, and a pilot plastics monitoring program to fill critical geographic gaps and inform future expansion of plastics monitoring, data collection, and analysis across the state. OPC recently approved funding to advance the statewide pilot monitoring program, which is in the process of being launched in coordination with the state water boards. As one example, the pilot is anticipated to leverage the State Water Board's existing Stream Pollution Trends Monitoring Program, or SPOT, to effectively expand microplastics monitoring across diverse land use types while also addressing key geographic gaps and environmental data gaps. Overall, developing a coordinated statewide monitoring program or a network that leverages existing and new monitoring programs requires an incremental approach that allows the state to apply results, lessons learned, and emerging science. Finally, monitoring can help inform priority areas for the state to invest in mitigating the impacts of plastic pollution. Plastic producers are required to pay $500 million annually to the state through the Plastic Pollution Mitigation Fund established by SB 54. These funds are required to be paid annually for 10 years, beginning in 2027, for a total of $5 billion to address plastic pollution across the state, and importantly, to understand and monitor where microplastics are affecting California communities and the environment, and track the efficacy of statewide efforts to address and reduce plastic pollution. This fund provides an important opportunity for the state to make informed, effective investments and provide needed funding to local communities and reduce the impacts and burdens of plastic pollution. With that, thank you for listening, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Kelly. Do we have any questions from the board? We have one, please.
Yeah, thank you for your detailed presentation. The question I have is specific to the very last slide. So if you can put it on the screen.
Yes, give me one moment.
The 500 million funding?
Yes.
Here we go. So where does CalRecycle fit in this picture?
CalRecycle alongside the California Natural Resources Agency headed by OPC, Strategic Growth Council, and the Department of Justice are currently coordinating, implementing the fund. It'll be legislatively appropriated in 2027, but we're currently in the process of developing an investment strategy with community input. So CalRecycle will be among one of the agencies administering the fund once it's legislatively appropriated.
The reason I bring it up is that, you know, if you follow the product chain, locations of recycling location is a big issue. And in many communities, you have very limited amount of location where you can recycle. So, you know, when looking at the solutions, that is clearly one that has been, I dare say, a weak point. Additionally, and if my memory serves me right, it's 2 or 3 years ago, there was also an effort made to have large grocery stores to accept recycled materials, which, by the way, is one of the European models. And there was a very strong pushback, and it didn't make it through the legislation. So I'm very curious to see how this SB 54 perhaps can, you know, enhance this gap associated with having accessible recycling locations and also incentive programs with the retailers to be able to accept recycled material.
Yes, I do think that's you know, the overarching goal of SB 54 to you know, expand infrastructure available for recycling. So that is certainly one of the possible avenues that could be make it more accessible to folks by incorporating it in grocery stores and making it accessible in other locations as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the board? We have one more.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Kelly, for your presentation. I was really happy to see that you included slides describing, or that the program involves characterizing the contribution that green infrastructure can make to reducing microplastics in the environment. At the same time, I'm dubious as to the extent to which it can, on a scale that's relevant, address the issue. And I was just wondering if you have any perspectives, having reviewed some of the research and findings from those really cool studies of biofilters and whatnot, as to the actual scalability of green infrastructure to address the magnitude of the microplastics flux through the environment.
I think it's, you know, one piece of the puzzle. Stormwater is one of the major pathways for microplastics in studies we found, you know, versus wastewater or other avenues. Stormwater definitely seems to be the biggest conduit. And so I think, you know, it's great that these green infrastructure can serve as a solution, and green infrastructure is for multiple contaminants. So I think it's nice that there's the co-benefit that these have for microplastics and other contaminants as well. So, I don't know that I can speak to the scalability specifically. I don't have a lot of knowledge in that area specifically, but I think as just, efforts to expand green infrastructure for other contaminants as well, will have co-benefits for microplastics as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Hearing none. Thank you so much, Dr. Kelly. Ryan?
Yeah, thank you, Kyla. We will now move on to our State Board Representative, Andrew Hamilton. He's the Assistant Deputy Director of the Office of Information Management and Analysis.
There you go. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
All right, great. And can you see my presentation?
Yes.
All right, great. Sorry for the delay there. Good morning, board members. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today on the work being done at the State Water Board on plastics and microplastics. I'm Andrew Hamilton, the Assistant Deputy Director of the Office of Information Management and Analysis at the State Water Board. And I'm joined today, I think, by my colleagues in the Division of Water Quality, the Division of Drinking Water, the Division of Financial Assistance, and the Office of Public Engagement, Equity, and Tribal Affairs. We represent a core group at the State Water Board who work on plastics and microplastics at some level in our respective roles and are available for questions after this brief presentation. I'll be sharing some of the current work and our ideas of proposed frameworks for future work during this short presentation. All right, I'm only briefly gonna go into the ubiquitous nature of plastics and microplastics in the environment, as Kyla already touched upon this in her presentation. But microplastics have been found in all types of California waters and are affecting communities in California. However, I would be hard-pressed to say that the water boards as a whole has a complete picture and a firm grasp on the full extent of this plastic pollution and how it may be impacting beneficial uses of the waters of the state. And that's namely because of the lack of standardized and accessible data. There are only disparate data available truthfully, a poor data infrastructure around characterizing plastics and microplastics occurrence throughout the state. And I'll be touching upon this a little bit more in future slides. An additional concern is that plastics can contain and carry harmful compounds like PFAS, 6-PPD quinone, phthalates, among others, that can leach into the waters and environments, or in some instances, like in PFAS, can absorb and adhere to the microplastics material, resulting in concerns of co-occurrence and even combined toxicity. I'm not specifically going to go into that today in my discussion, but it does represent another layer of complexity that needs to be considered when developing statewide monitoring plastics management strategies. All right, so there have been several key legislative drivers over the past 20 years that have spurred the water boards to begin foundational plastics work despite limited resources, and in some cases not even being specifically directed into action within the bill. Assembly Bill 258 was the first major plastics law affecting the water boards and required control of discharges containing pre-production plastics pellets or nurdles. This gave us early insight into how plastics enter waterways and was the water board's first major foray into plastics control and major or removal strategies to protect California waters. More recently, in 2018, two laws expanded our entrance into the plastics world. SB 1422 directed the Division of Drinking Water to define microplastics in drinking water, develop testing methods, and establish a monitoring and reporting framework for drinking water purposes. Our fellow presenter, Scott Coffin, who's going to be presenting later, was a major player in this one at this time at the State Water Board. SB 1263 directed the Ocean Protection Council to develop a statewide microplastic strategy, of which the State Water Board played a significant advisory role in sh help shaping. And more recently, SB 54, of which OPC already discussed, was adopted to create a broad plastic pollution reduction framework and the Plastic Pollution Mitigation Fund. We are excited about the possibilities of SB 54. Even with the limited resources, the water boards have taken important foundational steps towards addressing plastics pollution and building capacity for plastics monitoring and data collection. On the stormwater side, we've implemented trash provisions and enforced controls on pre-production pellets to keep plastics out of our waterways. Through wastewater and CEC programs, or compounds of emerging concern programs, we've supported treatment technologies that remove microplastics and started tracking related contaminants like PFAS and 6-PB quinone in our waters. The Division of Drinking Water has successfully established the nation's first definition of microplastics and created standardized analytical methods and offered those methods for laboratory accreditation, which is the first step towards building capacity for microplastics monitoring in drinking water. We're not quite there, but it is first steps to build that capacity. Additionally, the State Water Board supported the Ocean Protection Council and the San Francisco Estuary Institute in the development of California's statewide microplastics strategy, which helped elucidate the analytical and data management infrastructure and challenges and needs at the water boards. This also sparked interest and opportunity for OEMA, that's the office that I work in partnership with the Ocean Protection Council, to launch a microplastics pilot study that will leverage resources and contractors of the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program, the subprogram. Surface Stream Pollution Trends Program. That's what Kyla was alluding to earlier in our slides. I'm going to go into this a little in greater detail in future slides. Although these are only foundational steps and only scratch the surface of the plastics work that's needed to be done, these actions have given the state water boards early insight into the monitoring resource and inter and intra-agency coordination needs for a comprehensive microplastics approach going forward. To be honest, there are some significant challenges to overcome when working in this arena. Microplastics are everywhere, but we don't really have consistent comprehensive data that describes and characterizes that occurrence. Across California waters. Some regional monitoring efforts do exist, I'm not, and independent studies. So there is data out there, but they're mostly at regional and water body specific scales. So we need to fill those gaps, those data deserts, to get a better understanding of the plastic pollution landscape, and then so that we can inform potential risks, impacts to beneficial uses, or future mitigation regulatory actions. Additionally, there's a need for a standardized data management infrastructure with guidance on data standards and minimum data elements for plastics data, which will help with data quality, data comparability, and data usability, and ultimately help scale up work in the plastics arena. Wynn, or Dr. Kalger, and the Moore Institute, and again, another presenter, is doing some great work in this for the drinking water side. But we still need some standardization across other water and data types. There's also a lack of standardized analytical methods for characterizing microplastics in environmental matrices like sediment and biota. Kyla mentioned some work that has gone early on, and we can also lean on some beginning work from the Division of Drinking Water of their methods have developed specifically for drinking water matrices. Yeah, SCORP has done some early work, as I mentioned, in developing these methods in sediment biota, but that work still needs some further efforts, like multi-lab validation, multi-lab comparison studies to determine their performance, accuracy, and robustness for scalability across the state. Similar, there's work to be done to establish standardized sampling and field protocols that will minimize contamination from sampling activities that could bias the data, as well as will ensure the collection of samples that are representative of the waters they are collected from. Again, there's some early work on this, but there's just, we need to expand on that work to really have a robust, scalable program or monitoring efforts. Having these standardized methods and protocols will also help drive capacity to do plastics monitoring across the state. We are hopeful that that capacity is coming, and the work that's being done can help drive that. Without quality data and sufficient capacity to collect the data, the State Water Board cannot properly characterize occurrence, inform exposure risk, or identify potential impacts at the state level, especially those impacts to tribes and disadvantaged communities that may be disproportionately burdened by plastics pollution. And lastly, this is always a concern, like limited funding and resources. State Water Board and water boards in general can't yet build a comprehensive statewide program or strategy that is needed to sufficiently address plastics pollution. However, we're hopeful that funds will be coming. Okay. To build a statewide microplastics program or strategy at the water boards, we need both the scientific foundation and the equitable governance structure to support it. On the science and data collection side, this means developing coordinated monitoring plans, standardizing methods for use across all water types and matrices, establishing quality assurance and quality control protocols that drive data quality, and managing field sampling and laboratory analysis. We also need a statewide plastics data system or repository that can house data that is transparent, defensible, and accessible to the public. This will help inform hotspots and sources, prioritize investments in infrastructure, and potentially regulatory management actions to protect California waters. Equity also has to be integrated into any strategy that is developed from the beginning. This could come in different forms, like providing support and expansion of community science programs and efforts to empower local groups to be part of the solution, or conducting meaningful consultations with tribes and engagements with disadvantaged communities to learn from them and identify needs early on in the process to help shape or drive where to prioritize investments and resources. Our next steps at the State Water Board are to focus on early pilot work, small targeted projects that help us fill key data and knowledge gaps, and understand what types of actions might be scalable at a statewide level. I want to focus on the first two pilots listed, which I'll highlight in next two slides. The first pilot project is a microplastics monitoring project that will be conducted in partnership with the Ocean Protection Council and leverage existing contractors and infrastructures of the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program. This pilot project will help the water boards fill statewide data gaps by prioritizing sampling and data gathering at locations where we just don't yet have sufficient information on microplastics. Now, that's going to require, a huge undertaking. It's an intensive synthesis of existing data and data resources to inform candidate sampling locations, and that's no small task. So that's going to be something that's going to initially drive where we prioritize data collection. This pilot will also help test early field and analytical methodologies, specifically those ones that were in early development. We could probably utilize them in this pilot and then hopefully give them some more scalability or inform whether or not they're ready for statewide use. We also want to validate data workflows and integrate with existing monitoring networks like the Bay RNP or the BITE program, which are large-scale, like regional programs, to consolidate and leverage data resources. These early steps will help determine scalability of monitoring efforts, early mapping of microplastics contamination across the state, and inform next steps for future monitoring efforts. The hopes are that this pilot gives us the technical footing required to build out a large-scale statewide monitoring program, and we're very hopeful. The second pilot example shows how upstream action can make an immediate difference. This is a pilot managed by our Division of Financial Assistance.
We have a question from a board member. Apologies for interrupting you there.
No problem. Sorry. I can talk.
So thank you. So can you, sorry to interrupt your cadence, but
No, no problem.
can you go to the previous slide?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. So on pilot project, you know, where we, and perhaps some of the other speakers will address this, but, you know, there are different sources of a microplastics, and, you know, one, styrofoam is one big example, and then other forms of plastics. So in this study, would it include looking at which particular types of plastics seems to be the biggest contributor to microplastics? And I'm thinking more generally the old 80-20 rules. Quite often, you know, one single product or packaging material has a disproportionately large contribution to the microplastic pollution. So is this going to be part of this pilot project, which then would help prioritize which specific plastics, you know, need closer attention from a down the road regulatory standpoint, you know, with the manufacturers?
Somewhat. So you touch upon something that is definitely somewhat of a futuristic management question that we want to address. One of the main challenges, and I alluded to it in previous slides, that we have is our data, like our data standards and kind of minimum data elements that we need to include. So when collecting microplastics data, and I'm sure Scott or Wynn will be discussing some of this in their slides. When we characterize the microplastic particle that we've detected, I mean, there can be different characteristics that are included: size, shape, color, morphology, content, and so all of those can have individual risks associated with them, and so. We want to be robust enough in our data standard and our data elements so that we can capture that type of information. So if we're having an abundance of styrofoam materials or even tire particles, because that's a big one as well, these are ways that we can capture that information by having a robust data standard so that the characterization of that particle is included in our data, and then we can tease that out and look at trends and see where potentially there's like you said, styrofoam that may be a more prolific in certain areas or regions versus others. It's not a specific target goal of this pilot, but when we expand into a larger program, that would be something that we want to venture into.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Quickly, let me just jump into this real quick, and then we're almost done. So, and then we can have open forum for questions. So this pilot is managed by our Division of Financial Assistance. It's the Tijuana Trash Room intercepts trash and plastics before they can enter sensitive habitats. In the last storm season alone, it's prevented more than 1,300 tons of trash from flowing downstream, which has direct benefits to the severely disadvantaged communities in the Tijuana River Valley, by minimizing potential sources of macro and microplastics. This pilot helps us understand not only how to affect upstream interception, how effective upstream interception can be, but also what kinds of resources, maintenance, and long-term planning are required to sustain it. Right now, operations rely on emergency funding, and that's not sustainable. But we're It does, this project does show what it could take to scale similar efforts elsewhere, and help inform other future mitigation strategies. Together with a microplastics pilot, the Trash Room demonstrates how early pilots help us learn, adapt, and prepare for statewide approaches to plastics pollution. As we consider scaling practical solutions, data collection efforts, and establishing a more holistic approach to address plastics pollution in our waters, this is obviously funding and resource dependent. What would success look like for us? Success would for us would mean California is using clear, trusted data that is publicly available to elucidate and support the understanding of key management questions, like where are the hotspots? What are the major sources? How do plastics and microplastics move through our waters? What are the impacts to communities, ecosystems, and ecoregions? And how are conditions changing over time? Success means management decisions and actions are guided by solid evidence and data. So we can test solutions, refine them, and apply regulatory tools where necessary to truly make a difference. And because plastics pollution doesn't affect all communities equally, success also means building lasting partnerships with tribes and disadvantaged communities, centering their knowledge and priorities in the work we do. And then finally, success is about long-term capacity, having stable resources to continue the monitoring, engage with communities, support the infrastructure upgrades, and strengthen solutions over time. If we can build this foundation, California will be equipped with a durable statewide plastics and microplastics program rooted in science, equity, and collaboration. And with that, I just list my contact information or another environmental program manager, Laura Wardrip. She won't be available today for questions, but you can reach out to either one of us or myself or fellow colleagues are available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Do you have any questions? We have one question from a board member.
I wanted to follow up on Member Wolf's comments, and in terms of what success looks like, and I appreciate there's success for the pilot program, but for me, looking at the science, and you're talking about the science, the data we produce is maybe going to drive some regulatory change, and I appreciate that we need to stay in the lane that we're in the water lane, but ultimately we have to stop the production of these plastics. Or to change the type of plastics. And for me, that ties into science and research. And a lot of that's been defunded or is not being supported. So I know we have someone that's presenting from UC, but if there's a way that our science can also be in partnership with people in the research community that are looking at ways to change plastics and do that analysis so that we don't have all of these. I feel like we're sort of rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic at this point because the plastics just keep coming. So unless we change the nature of the plastics, we'll continue to have this problem. So that would just be my ask is for the future, once you've got the first round of success, is that we look at, using that data in ways that can and help us in the future. Thank you.
Any other questions from the board? Seeing none, thank you so much, Mr. Hamilton. We appreciate your presentation. Thanks.
Thank you, Andrew. With that, we will move on to our next speaker, Dr. Wen Kauger. He's the Executive Director of the Moore Institute. Welcome.
Hello. I am requesting access to share my screen.
We're sharing it for you. One moment.
Okay. Great. Can you see that
Yes, thank you.
now? Okay. I'm Dr. Wen Kauger, Executive Director of the Moore Institute for Plastic Pollution Research. We are an accredited microplastic lab in Long Beach. I'm also the first Pew Gerstner Ocean Plastics Research Fellow. I'm going to be talking about one of the projects that we have up in the Monterey Bay and also how we're running our accredited lab and some of the new methods that we're trying to develop to make real-time monitoring of microplastics possible. Okay. There we go. So, this project we got funded from the Ocean Protection Council from Watershed to Whales. I'm really trying to track all the sources of microplastics going into the Monterey Bay and understand where microplastics are ending up, how they're getting there, really to inform risk assessments. This is in line with the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary's management plan to assess the scope and scale of marine debris. And the Marine Sanctuary is one of the main collaborators on this project too. So it's been really great to have them on the team and really have that direct translation of the science and them informing all of the priorities from the get-go. Monterey Bay does have a little bit of research historically on microplastics. It looks like going back to something like 2021, there was a study done trawling the surface of the Monterey Bay ocean waters for microplastics. And then there have been several studies looking at microplastics in deep sea organisms and other organisms within the bay. But what's really missing is a bigger understanding of how of the sources. And I really appreciated the comment from one of the water board members about really thinking upstream. How can we prevent this stuff? And so the sources primarily that we suspect right now for microplastics getting in the bay are the rivers. So microplastics can shed in urban areas primarily from large pieces of trash or tire wear breakdown or synthetic fibers from textiles. And then runoff will carry them down the river and to the ocean. Once they're in the ocean, they can move around in the bay. They could get eaten by organisms. They could also get washed up on the beaches. So we wanted to kind of naively try to make a mass balance, basically assessing the mass going in and then assessing the trying to see if that adds up to all of the masses that we are measuring in the bay. And so we are assessing the rivers, the beaches, the ocean, and the biota, trying to assess the mass concentrations of microplastics in all of those. We're looking at the chemistry of the microplastics, so the material type. We're looking at the shapes, the colors. We are also developing a citizen science campaign to look at microplastics on beaches, which is in collaboration with the National Marine Sanctuaries, but also the Surfrider chapter in the region is very active on this, and we're starting to pilot some projects with them. The impact here, so once we understand what types, how much, where are things go moving around, we can try to develop a risk assessment framework for assessing, what should we be most concerned about, what's likely to be most at risk. And we're working right now with Scott Coffin on that project. And so we're very early stages of that. I don't have any new data to share on that yet, but I will be sharing some preliminary data. The beach sand monitoring, that one has been it looks like this. So we basically go out and we conduct transects of the beach sand, and we're just looking at the surface sand. And then we float the microplastics out of the beach sand using ocean water, and we will characterize all the microplastics under a microscope. I'll show you what that looks like on some other slides. But this one has been the easiest thing that we can do to work with the community, and it's been a real community science effort, so that's been really cool. The ocean water sampling, we do have to go out on a boat. The National Marine Sanctuaries has been using their boat to go out, and we use a peristaltic pump to pump ocean surface water out of the bay, and then we run it through stacked sieves to size separate the particles. And then the river water sample. This was I really want to give a shout out to Pam from the National Marine Sanctuaries because this was her contraption that she devised to measure microplastics on the surface of the rivers. She's using an ISCO sampler and lowering it from a bridge. And having the intake of the ISCO sampler actually just dipping into the water. And then she has a whole setup where all the stacked sieves are kind of also hanging with that ISCO sampler. So that's been really cool to pilot that method. And this is what microplastics look like under the microscope. So we will do microscopy to extract these samples. So you can see up in the upper left-hand corner, this is what some of the samples look like. You just see a bunch of particles floating in some liquid. But once we look under the microscope, we can see some clear microplastic particles, fibers, different fragments of things. And we'll pick those out and characterize them by size, shape, material type. Some of the preliminary data that we're finding, the vast majority of the microplastic types seem to be textile fibers. So that could be shedding from clothing. That could also be just like long fragments coming off of other materials. But those are kind of the main suspected sources of microplastics in the region. There's also looking at the different sizes. So there's a spike in the sizes somewhere around 500 microns. Most of the particles are blue, black, or white. And the material types, most of the particles are polypropylene, polyethylene, polystyrenes, polyesters. This ends up being over 90% of the microplastics that we find. So there was a comment earlier from one of the members about, how can we identify the sources, and which industries should we try to work with to stop the sources. These would be the first industries I would reach out to: the polyolefin industries, the polystyrene industries, the polyester industries. Those are the ones that we're finding clear signals of their types of plastics coming in. It's really not these like more rare plastics like polyurethanes or PVCs, for example, that we are most worried about in terms of count concentrations. So I mentioned that our lab is an accredited lab. We got this accreditation over 2 years ago now, and we're processing hundreds, almost 1,000 samples a year for a variety of things these days. And we got that accreditation by doing we helped develop the accreditation with an interlab comparison study done in collaboration with SCORP and the water boards, where we tested standard spike samples and wanted to see, can 35 different labs get the same results? At that time, the only method that was really considered high quality enough was drinking water analysis. The rest of them had very high variability if you're looking at ocean water or sediment or fish tissue. And there's some new studies coming out of the SCORP BITE program that hopefully will be able to close the case on those other matrices. But for now, there's only accreditation for clean drinking water. And we do have that accreditation. The main reason why that's the only thing that could get accredited is because it's the easiest thing to sample. You can just filter your sample down, and then you look at the filter. The other sample types require extensive extraction procedures using harsh chemicals, and they end up in inputting a lot of variability into the outcome. So with the accreditation, we're constantly trying to refine our approach. We are developing new techniques for measuring samples. We got our first client ever reached out and wanted to process some drinking water. And at that time, we needed 100 liters of water. And we said, okay, per sample, you're going to need 100 liters of water. So you could ship that to our address. I think you're going to need a semi truck to be able to send all of this water to us, because you want 100 samples. And one sample here is going to weigh 100 kilograms. It's very unfeasible to do it this way. So the State Water Board, along with us, is also trying to figure out how to do sampling or extracting the sample a little bit more at the site, at the source of this of collection. And there's some different ways to do that. Stack sieves is kind of a classical way. Inline filtration, high capacity filtration. These are some different techniques to be able to just filter out the particles on site instead of having to ship water far distances. Our lab has developed this device called the TapTrap, which is made of all off-the-shelf parts. So you could pick these parts up at a standard hardware store or online very easily. And it's very similar to some of the inline filtration techniques that are currently recommended by the state. And we're piloting that right now. I mentioned that we can assess the material types of the microplastics that we find in samples. And how we do this is using spectroscopy. The classical way of doing spectroscopy analysis is collecting these chemical signatures and assessing them one at a time. So every single particle, you would need an expert looking at those signals and making a judgment call about what that is. This is not scalable because we have thousands of microplastic particles in every single sample. It would take, a week of somebody's time to go through that many. So we've developed an automated algorithm and software called OpenSpecy, which goes through and it will automatically do this procedure that an expert would have to do otherwise. And that's already online at openspecy.org. And this is one of the most widely used spectroscopy softwares in the field at this point. So that's also been really exciting. We've been collaborating with the water boards to try to figure out how to get data into Sedin or into other state repositories in a way that can reflect the complexity of microplastic data, because it's not just spreadsheets, it's images, it's spectral, hyperspectral data that you need to be able to actually analyze and fully interpret the results of a study. And at the time when we were doing this project, Sedin was not able to take in that data. I'm hoping Sedin 2.0, I've heard good things about it, and I think it might be able to. But we did develop this One for All portal, which is specifically for microplastic data, and taking data in from accredited labs and then sending it to data.ca.gov as like a single through line. But being very specialized to microplastic data so that we can really take into account that complexity and keep the richness of the data that's necessary for doing risk assessment. In closing, some new opportunities that I see coming down the line. So historically, microplastic analysis has cost about $3,000 a sample to process. My lab, as well as the other accredited labs, are now getting that cost down to $500 or less. This is now at the cost of PFAS sampling, for example. So at this point, I feel like financially, this is something that you can start doing large scale monitoring campaigns for this. We're also developing a first of its kind microplastic sampling service with a WEHA funded project. This project is going to help us so that for people who don't know how to do the inline filtration, like drinking water facilities and stuff like that, we can do that for them. Federal CCL listing might be on the horizon for microplastics, and this would trigger some very big wide-scale monitoring. And then SB 54 was already brought up previously, but that is likely to fund a substantial amount of microplastic monitoring, as far as I'm hearing so far. So we'll see when the actual RFPs come out. I'll leave this up in case anybody wants to screenshot it. But these are all my different contact points. So you can get all of our data is open source. Our code is open source. Our manuscripts are open. And we do a lot of public discourse on LinkedIn. So definitely give us a look there. I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Kaur. We have questions from our board.
Yes, thank you for an interesting presentation. And, I liked the slides where you were actually pinpointing some of the origins of microplastics. And when we think microplastics, predominantly we think plastics used as packaging material for solids and liquids.
Right.
But what about microfibers, which have become very popular, particularly in the textile industry?
Right.
The characteristics of microfibers also, has great similarities to some of these other microplastics. So, and I'm sure in your lab work, you probably identify those as well.
Right.
So, could you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, so those are going to be synthetic textiles like polyester, for example. I mean, it's actually very hard these days to find purely natural fiber clothing. Our lab is required to wear all natural fiber clothing. And even when we purchase things online, I'll get it, and then I can tell there's a synthetic waistband to it, or there's a synthetic like stretch additive in it. Usually at just like a few percentage when it's claimed to be like 100% natural. But yeah, these fibers are getting into the environment from dryers. So dryers exhaust directly to the atmosphere, and then they'll blow around, and they can go all the way to Antarctica or Mount Everest. These fibers are very easy to transport. Another source, probably a much smaller source, is going to be wastewater effluent, if they end up going through the wastewater effluent, and then just everyday shedding of these synthetic textile materials. They can end up sloughing off when you're using them, and then getting into the environment that way.
Thank you.
We have another question.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a great presentation, and I'm really impressed with the Moore Institute's extensive work in this area.
Thank you.
I think the Moore Institute is founded by Charles Moore, is that correct?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah,
he's one
yeah.
of our founders.
I met him years ago, and he was just kind of getting started with his boat, going out and looking at the giant garbage patch. And
right.
The thing that's so critical about what you all are doing is it's the bridge using community science, or what used to be called citizen science or citizen monitoring when I first got involved with it. It's that bridge. The vector for most of these pollutants are human beings, and
right.
to raise the consciousness of the human vector as to the fate of all these contaminants is really critical. And so to see people out there sweeping sand into dustbins and getting involved in the actual characterization, I think it can't be overstated how important that is. You know, if you think back to the 60s when they had the advertisements with the crying actor who pretended to be Native American, you know, it really did. It did result in some degree of awareness and improvement on, you know, the litter campaign, as it was reducing litter. And there's been, you know, lots of efforts like what was it? Don't Trash Texas was what was it? Don't Trash Texas or Don't Trash California? The one for Texas, I can't remember, but it was the first one. And these are big, important campaigns. I think it's critical that we engage the public to the degree possible. I know that the Water Board has, over the years, put some funding into community science and promoting it. And I was curious, I don't know if any of the State Water Board people are still in the call, but I would be interested in knowing what the status of the Clean Water Team is, if it's still in existence. Again, thank you for the presentation, Wynn, and I think what you guys are doing is super important, and I want to see it continue, so thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You wanted to respond, Mr. Hamilton?
Yeah, I can respond. Yeah, the Clean Water Team is still in existence. That's under our Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program. And we also have some other new staff within the swamp program that is starting to expand on those efforts. So we are trying to bring more community science into our swamp programs. And we even have a new initiative, which is we're calling it the BioBlitz, which basically incorporates all of our sampling protocols into one, but we're working with tribes and local monitoring groups to implement them and give them the tools and resources to do the monitoring by themselves so that we can expand our networks and help support local monitoring efforts.
Thank you. We have another question from a board member.
Hi, thank you. A few slides back, you listed all the different polys. And I didn't know what the top one referred to, but it was, I think, 70% of the source.
Yeah, that one was polyolefin. And that one is, it's a broader category that includes polyethylenes and polypropylenes.
And so what would be examples of the products that would let that off?
Yeah, the main ones are going to be food packaging. So lots of food packaging. Food packagings are primarily polyethylenes and polypropylenes, especially like layered films, things like that. bottle caps.
Are there, I believe Oregon has some packaging laws now that are requiring companies to track their packaging. Is some of the legislation that was mentioned before, and maybe this goes more to the water board folks, but is it specifically trying to address them that, significant source of these pollutants?
Yeah, that's a good question for the water board. I'm not sure. That would be with SB 54 would probably be the main one, and I'm not sure if they're incorporating. Does anybody else know if they're incorporating the material types into how they're what we're seeing in the environment into how they're ranking the different polluters? Not seeing anybody, so I'm not sure. Yeah.
I believe that's part of the strategy. I don't know, Andrew, do you know? Part of the overall strategy is the source control, which I think leads to different types of products and packaging in the future.
Yeah, that might be that's I'm not sh there's two different funds that are established by SB 54, I believe, and so that might it I'm not sure if that's part of the PPMF side of things, but I think it for the overall SB 54 there might be some of that work being done.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have any more questions? I have one quick question, Dr. Kauger. You had mentioned that your lab is one of three that's accredited globally.
Yep.
The other two labs, do you know where they are, or would you tell us where they are, I should say?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Eurofins is in Sacramento, and McCampbell Analytical is in the East Bay Area. I'm trying to remember what town they're in. Pittsburgh, I think.
So all three are in the US,
Yep, all
basically.
three are in California.
Oh, in California, even
Yeah.
better. Thank you. Do
Yeah.
we have any more questions? Hearing none, thank you, Dr. Kauger.
Thank
Appreciate your
you.
time.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Kauger. Our next speaker is going to be Dr. Andrew Gray, Associate Professor at UC Riverside.
Hey everyone, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Great. And can you see my screen?
Yes.
Excellent. Great. Well, it's nice to follow Wynn on this since he's covered a lot of the bases in terms of sample analysis and lay the groundwork for talking about transport as well. Today I'm gonna focus on rivers and estuaries. First, I'd like to introduce some of my team, past and present. That includes Wynn Kauger, who's a PhD alum out of my lab, has gone on and to bigger and greater things since then. We still have three grad students right now working on microplastics, and we usually have somewhere between 10 and 15 undergraduates helping us because of the tremendous amount of manual effort under visual microscopy that's required to analyze microplastics these days, although that is changing, as Wynn has touched on, and I'll touch on that a little bit again at the end as well. We've also been collaborating with lots of folks on this, and I've highlighted or squared in here the three largest collaborators on the work I'll talk about today. We're really getting interested in estuaries a lot for a number of reasons. One is the fact that rivers are the largest conveyance of plastic pollutants from terrestrial Earth, where most of them are being produced and then shed into the environment, to the oceans. And that means that estuaries end up bearing a large load of plastic pollutants, including microplastics, and are also a critical modulator of what actually makes it into the ocean. So on the global scale, most efforts to estimate how much microplastics are entering the ocean haven't taken estuarine processes into account. But this is also very important in terms of regional monitoring and management as well, because we need to really get a better idea of what's happening in these estuaries to characterize the risks that microplastics may pose to them. So this really starts with a boundary condition, right, where we have microplastics flux that's coming into these estuaries from rivers, and then we have estuarine processes that are interacting with them. So let's start with riverine microplastic fluxes and kind of what we have to do to start wrapping our arms around that and characterizing it. Really requires that we monitor concentration and water discharge at the same time so that we can calculate how much microplastics are being transported through a given river cross section. You know, if we look out at how most people have been sampling microplastics globally up until recently, and these are old data that a previous student of mine pulled together, we're reanalyzing it now. The essential view is the same. Previous studies have mostly collected samples that are too small, without discharge data, mostly at the surface or subsurface of flow, mostly at a single point, and under low flow conditions. So essentially, most researchers have been approaching riverine microplastics as opportunistic ambient water quality studies. That makes sense, right? Given, you know, lack of resources and the short temporal scope of most research studies when people first get started. Let's take a step back then and think about how we should actually be monitoring microplastics in rivers. The stuff I'm going to talk about now, we've been thinking about this for a long time as we get started with sampling and then analyzing microplastics in rivers, going back, you know, over 7 years ago. But just recently, over the last few years, we've been working with the California Ocean Protection Council and SQRP, and then also leveraging other work that we're doing with the Safe Clean Water Program down here in LA County, to explicitly test different microplastics monitoring sampling devices and strategies through physical experiments in a flume, and then also through field trials. So if we start to kind of walk through what is really required to collect representative samples from river flow for a number of different purposes for microplastics analysis and application, we need representative samples. Most of us are still stuck on the approach of analyzing microplastics on a particle basis. And even if we weren't, we're fundamentally analyzing particles. So we need samples that are large enough to have the kind of power to answer the kinds of questions we want, but also just to represent those populations. And that usually starts around 100 particles or so, but you may require many, many more than that, depending on what you're trying to do. We tend to have much lower concentrations of microplastics as we go up in size because of the detrital nature of these particles, because they're breaking down into numerous smaller particles. So that means for the larger particles that most of us have been limited to analyzing up until recently, so say a couple hundred microns and larger, up to 5 millimeters, we tend to need hundreds, if not thousands of liters of water to collect a representative sample. As we move into fine microplastics, we may get away with a liter of sample or tens of liters. Another issue that we have to deal with because we're actually going after particles rather than dissolved constituents is the fact that their concentration and position in the flow field is maintained by this turbulent, or rather this interaction between the settling or rising velocity of those particles and the turbulent energy of the flow. So just by introducing samplers, we can bias that situation. Folks in the suspended sediment sampling field have known this for many, many decades, and it's resulted in the development of isokinetic samplers that disturb that flow field as little as possible so as not to bias the sample. Another issue that stems from the fact that we're trying to sample and then analyze particles in river flow, and this is work I'm highlighting that Wynn did in our lab, you know, and published over 5 years ago, is the fact that the turbulence of the flow field and the rising or settling velocity of these particles result in concentration depth profiles for particles that have high rising or settling velocities. So in general, larger microplastics particles that are very low density or very high density will tend to be found in higher concentrations toward the bed or toward the surface. That then necessitates likely the use of isokinetic samplers that are then raised and lowered through the depth column, and then perhaps even at multiple points across the cross section of a river to get an actual representative sample. Another important thing to point out, though, is that most fine microplastics, so say like less than 100 microns or so, will actually be transported as wash load, which means that they're fully mixed and have a uniform concentration across the depth and width profile of most flow conditions. So that's something to think about moving forward as we start to design sampling plans. to be employed more broadly throughout the state and with many users. So the flume trials that we've been conducting in Santa Barbara and Vamsigante's flume, it's a 15 meter long flume. It's 2 meters wide. We can fill it up to 1 meter deep and run a wide variety of discharge magnitudes through it. We've been testing isokinetic bottle samplers developed by the USGS for suspended sediment, two different kinds of pumps, like a high volume submersible pump, and then also a peristaltic pump, as well as a simple dip method. So it's basically throwing a bucket into the water. And a net-based system that's also quasi-isokinetic called in this case, it's the BL84, developed for bed load monitoring, but we put a current meter in the front of it and use it as a microplastics suspended sediment or suspended load monitoring system. We've also been doing similar work out in rivers across Southern California, again, using the BL84 system, the isokinetic bottle, the dip bucket, and then peristaltic pumps at mass emission stations run by LA County Public Works. I'm not going to go into all that report. We're submitting the final draft in collaboration with SQRP to OPC at the end of October. It gets a little complicated, right? Because at the end of the day, development of these kinds of procedures really have to serve the goals of a given study, and then also depend on the targeted classes of microplastics, their actual concentrations, and then the hydraulic conditions that those plastics are interacting with. But essentially, if we're going to try to monitor riverine microplastics for the purpose of trying to estimate flux, you know, we really need, in all cases, we need to collect sufficient sample sizes. If we're going to include coarse microplastics, we should use isokinetic techniques that are flow integrated, ideally. And then that also has to be informed by the time and discharge regime so that we can collect sufficient samples across the range of discharge to estimate flux. And so that's what my group has been doing from the get-go. This is very, very work intensive. Not many groups are going to do this. So as we move forward, there will be guidance for simplifying this. Okay, so let's move into a case study where we're actually have gone out and monitored the two major fluvial inputs. So this is Newport Bay in Southern California. We have two major riverine inputs. One is the Santa Ana Delhi channel, that's fully constructed stormwater channel, and then the San Diego Creek. San Diego Creek drains almost an order of magnitude larger watershed than Santa Ana Delhi. It also has some undeveloped land, whereas Santa Ana Delhi is almost exclusively urbanized. There's been a lot of change to these watersheds over the last 100, 150 years. And that's resulted in a number of modifications to the system, but also has engendered a lot of microplastic loading of this system as well. And so this work was all funded by the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board. We've been partnering with them on this work since about 2021. And we just finished the second phase of the study and submitted our report this summer. I don't have time to touch on everything that we did there, but I just want to get into some of the highlights. So we conducted transport-informed sampling and were able to calculate microplastic fluxes in terms of all microplastics, non-fibers, tire and roadwear particles. The two publications that have resulted in that so far are highlighted here. You can access them. They're open access. You can also get in touch with me if you want to look at them and talk about them. I'm not going to go into all the details there, of course, but the top contour is that you see on the order of tens of billions of microplastics that are, and these are coarse microplastics greater than 250 microns that are entering Newport Bay during this 2021 water year. About 75% of that, roughly, was coming from the Santa Ana Delhi channel, so the much smaller watershed that's more highly urbanized. The vast majority of those microplastics are being discharged by storm flow rather than the low flow conditions that are the most prevalent throughout the year. So these kind of rare rainfall runoff events are transporting most of the microplastics. A high proportion of those microplastics are tire and roadwear particles. And perhaps the highest is microfibers, but that's by count, not by mass. They end up making up a relatively small proportion of the mass of the samples, but are very abundant. So then what happens to these microplastics in Newport Bay? This is the second phase of the study with the Santa Ana Regional Board. So we went out and collected a lot of sediment samples. a number of cores from the marsh platform in the northern part of the of Newport Bay, as well as benthic grabs, kind of shallow 0 to 5 centimeter sediment samples throughout the bay. If we take a look at those concentrations, we have a large spatial variability. As you would expect, we have higher concentrations in general up in the upstream portion of the bay, the head of the bay, close to those fluvial inputs, where we have these basins that are actively managed and maintained specifically to trap sediment that's coming out of San Diego Creek, especially. But they're also acting to trap microplastics. And you know, if we look at partitioning by morphology, we see that tire and roadwear particles are a large proportion of what we're finding, you know, around a third of the microplastics in the basins at the head of the bay. We also have some evidence of tire and roadwear particles coming in at the Pacific Coast Highway. And in general, foams, these like really low density microplastics, we tend to find them outside of these sedimentation basins, particularly up on the marsh platform. And from a mass basis, fragments in tire and roadwear particles again are dominating relative to microfibers. We have a bunch of other polymer specific information, but essentially it's what we tend to find throughout the world, right? We find a lot of these polyolefins and other thermoplastics, most of which are associated with packaging, that are dominating the fragments and the fibers that we're finding. And then the tire and roadwear particles are a separate class. So it's important to keep in mind that we do have intensive sediment management in Newport Bay. Those two basins I mentioned, Unit 1-3 and then Unit 2, Basin 2, are both dredged on, you know, about a decadal basis or so. And then there's also lower navigation channels that are dredged as well. We're able to exploit those bathymetric records and dredging records to help us develop estimates of sedimentation rates in these basins that we can then use to estimate trapping rates for microplastics as well. And the upshot is, you know, if we take a look at our fluvial inputs for water year 2021, you can see this on the order of, you know, tens of billions of microplastics for all microplastics down to hundreds of, yeah, down to single digit billions of tire and roadwear particles. If you compare that to what we're estimating on the basis of these samples throughout the bay are being stored in the sediment, we can see that a high proportion of the microplastics appear to be retained in Newport Bay. And in particular, the tire and roadwear particles, most of which appear to not be leaving upper Newport Bay. They're getting trapped in these sediment basins, which are designed to capture mineral sediment. It's also important to note, though, that again, these are the coarser end of the microplastics regime, so 250 microns and higher. There's a lot more work to be done to understand what's happening with the finer fraction of microplastics. In the marsh cores that we collected, we did a lot of kind of detailed sedimentology work on these cores. And we also dated them using fallout radionuclide analysis, which we do in my lab, using lead-210 and radiocesium. The upshot there is that we have these exponentially increasing microplastic accumulation rates, as you would expect, right? As we move from the onsite of plastic production, or at least industrial plastic production in the post-war era up to the present. And we also see a gradient in not only the amount of microplastics, but the kinds of microplastics that we find as we move from near open water in the marsh up toward the periphery of the marsh that's kind of closer to the urban zone. That includes shift in fiber dominance as well. And we have some suggestions of potential atmospheric transport that may be playing a big role in delivering microfibers to the marsh platform as well, but we need to do more work to follow up on that. So we didn't only conduct sampling in this system. We also developed and ran a hydrodynamic model based on the Delph3D platform, and not only to run the hydrodynamics of the system, how water's moving through it, but then to use that to better understand how the microplastics are moving through the system. And I don't have time to get into all the details. This is work that it's really critical that Matt Brand, who's now at LSU, was working with us on this and helping to co-advise my student Claire Murphy Hagen, who did all this modeling. But the big thing I want to point out is that what we're finding in the model so far supports it matches up well with the kinds of samples that we've the sample data that we found as well, that shows that the basins are capturing a lot of our fragments, including tire and road wear particles. And if we go through the benefit of using models is that we can actually manipulate the system without having to wait for it to change, to run different scenarios. And what we find is that probably as you would expect, when larger events are discharging lots of microplastics into these systems, the capture efficiency of those basins is lower, they get overwhelmed. But also over time, as those basins are filling up with sediment, their capture efficiency is going down too. So this brings into the conversation the fact that, you know, we have to think about microplastics in the context of these managed sedimentary systems as well, which then also bleeds over into thinking about what we do with those sediments after they're dredged. So just some final thoughts. You know, for riverine microplastics monitoring procedures, I would highly recommend as a state we consider, you know, there's a lot of things that we're going to have to, that all of you will have to do and be involved in when it comes to monitoring microplastics in rivers and streams across the state and in your region. But I would suggest that we consider focusing quite a bit of effort on effective events, so larger storm flows that are probably moving most of these microplastics, and that we really pay close attention to how we should be collecting representative, transport-informed samples, and also how we can do that in a more simplified way. And the next step for my group, you know, after this work with SQRP and OPC, is that we're moving forward with the development of a field study design tool to try to make this process more user friendly. And I'd be happy to talk with you all more about that as well. Estuarine sediments are large potential sinks of microplastics, but that's really in large part dependent on the physics of the system that those fluvial microplastics are interacting with. So Newport Bay is already really good at trapping sediments, and it seems to be really good at trapping microplastics. Not all of the estuaries in the state are like that. And even in Newport Bay, we're still missing some important processes. We're not incorporating flocculation dynamics, so how especially smaller particles stick to other particles and then changes their effective rising slash settling velocities. And we're not explicitly incorporating atmospheric contribution of microplastics, which is super important, particularly as we start moving into these smaller particles. Both of these dynamics and supply dynamics will be important. And then finally, as we move into these smaller microplastics and trying to conduct studies that include more particles and more samples so that we have more power to answer questions that are relevant for management, we need high throughput analysis. We need to move into finer microplastics. And that really, at this point, for particle-based analysis, is through automated hyperspectral microimaging. Wind's been a really big proponent and driver of this in the field, and my group's chasing this as well as many others are. And this, I think, also highlights the need to double down and invest in groups that are already running the ball on these kinds of things so they can make that next step to try to amplify the amount and number of samples that we can process and collect for the state. And with that, I'd like to thank our funders for this work and thank all of you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Gray. We have Board Member Wolf has a question for you.
So thank you for your presentation. And I was particularly interested in your sampling technique and, you know, developing a more accurate means of sampling, since, you know, that's basically the core of the topic, is to have reliable data. And so my question, maybe I'm getting down to the weeds, or in this case, the algaes, but when You mentioned the kinetic effects of water flows and how the particles are moving and then performing sampling close to the surface, bottom of a stream, and you know, different layers. Does temperature impact the behavior of the particles? You know, particularly as we're looking at extreme temperature changes that we're seeing more and more, does that have any relevancy in the accuracy of the data?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. It certainly does have an impact. So changes in temperature alone, say, of the water that's moving these particles will change the density of the water slightly. And so that does have impacts. It has impacts in the river, and it also has impacts in the estuary. But, you know, in terms of kind of the wide range of variables that could be impacting the supply and transport of microplastics through these systems that we're having to account for already, I would say temperature is pretty far down the list. But that said, in estuaries, it could be, I would imagine, more important than in rivers, as we're dealing with ranges of density stratification, primarily in many cases driven by salt content, but temperature could also be potentially important as well. Yeah.
Thank you.
Do you have another question for you, sir?
Yes, thanks very much, Dr. Gray, for your presentation. It's really interesting. Love to hear about methods and the development of new ones. And I just a quick question, hopefully it's quick. I don't want you to maybe expound too much, but I'm curious, what does a field study design tool consist of? Is it a software package, or is it a field manual? But that seems like an effort to influence methodologies for people undertaking the studies going forward, and that you're going to put effort into that implies you have some good ideas and you think it's a big need. So I'm curious what it involves.
Yeah. This is something my group's been thinking about for a while, and it's become more and more pressing, you know, as we've delved more explicitly into method development. So the work that we're doing with SQRP for OPC right now, the deliverable will include a standard operating procedure that will be a written document that provides guidance and then very kind of specific step-by-step SOPs for particular kinds of studies. But that's just the beginning, and that's not extremely user-friendly. It is for, say, a given study that has goals that are directly aligned with what those specifically written out SOPs are aligned with. And we'll have the guidance to help people design a study that goes outside of those kind of limited parameters for those given SOPs. But I think the whole field in the state will be better served by something that's more user-friendly. So the tool that I am talking about developing is more like a software package. Yeah. And we have certain components of it that we've built and that other collaborators have built. But this package will be drawing on those other packages and have a wrapper that brings together, that guides groups through the development of a field sampling plan, starting with study goals, right, and targeted systems.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah.
Do we have any other questions from the board? Hearing none, thank you so much, Dr. Gray. We really appreciate your information.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Gray. And our last speaker on the microplastics item is Dr. Scott Coffin. He's a staff toxicologist specialist from the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. Welcome, Scott.
Morning, board members. And it's really a pleasure to be here and to join some of my fellow fantastic scientists that I've been working with for years on a topic that I'm really passionate about. Can everyone see my screen okay?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Fantastic. So I'm going to talk to you today about the risk assessment methods that I've developed at the State Water Board and at the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, or WEHA, for assessing ecological risks specifically. Three main topics: how to assess the risks of ecosystem harm from microplastics, and how it's been applied in California in San Francisco Bay. And then I'll touch a little bit about an exciting project that is underway to develop source fingerprinting methods. So, as covered before by Andrew, California Senate Bill 1263 required the State Water Board and the Ocean Protection Council to develop a risk assessment framework by 2026. And this is really the requirement that enabled the work that I've done and that I'll be talking about today. In order to fulfill this mandate, we convened a human and ecological health effects workshop between 2020 and 2022. This was coordinated by SQIRP, and I ran this in collaboration with academic partners, as well as the primary goal of this workshop was really to provide a scientific foundation for the State Water Board, as well as the Ocean Protection Council, to assess not only the human health risks, but also ecological health risks of microplastics. And as part of this effort, we conducted a systematic literature review, collecting all the data that was available at the time on the toxicity of microplastics. And we charged our academic partners in this workshop with some charge questions dealing with the dose metrics. So, what is it about microplastics that causes harm? Is it the volume of the particles? Is it the surface area, the count, the mass? What particle characteristics determine the toxicity? Are there adverse effects that are consistently observed across studies? And can we use existing data and frameworks to establish regulatory thresholds? And we identified three main ways that these microplastic particles can be hazardous to ecological biota as well as human health. The particles themselves can be toxic through a number of different means. They can also act as transport mechanisms for pathogens, for instance, viruses and bacteria, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, enriching hubs. And they can also transfer chemicals, which we know to be toxic, such as bisphenol A or BPA. As for the health effects induced by the physical properties of microplastics, when it comes to aquatic biota, we think about four main ways. These can be hazardous: entanglement by fibers for very small organisms like C. daphnia, as shown in this video, as well as entanglement from the larger macroplastics that we've all seen pictures of, I'm sure, in the ocean. Food dilution. This one's very easy to conceptualize. Plastic has no nutritional value and it can take up space in an organism's gut, causing low satiation, low energy, and eventually starvation. Internal lacerations from the particles themselves. These typically happen from larger particles. And then at the very small sizes, we consider cellular-based impacts due to inflammation and oxidative stress. An issue that the field has grappled with for a very long time, and that our health effects work group really focused and honed in on, was the fact that plastics are never the same. We are dealing with really a constellation of infinite different combinations of sizes, shapes, colors, polymer types, surface oxidation, and other properties. And in order to assess the hazards, we really have to get a bit more creative than just taking a single type of microplastic and trying to extrapolate it to the universe that we find in the environment. And in particular, we've observed that many of the laboratory studies use very specific types of microplastics that are not representative of what is in the environment. Typically, these studies use polystyrene beads of a very specific size that have no additives. They've not experienced any weathering. We call these monodisperse. And in the environment, organisms are almost exclusively exposed to the opposite, which is polydisperse, weathered, biofilms, contaminants, many different polymer types. And so when you try and collapse the data in different ways, maybe putting it into sort of different size bins, researchers have tried to split up the data by many, many different ways, and you always get completely different answers. It's really not a great way of dealing with such a diverse contaminant suite. This is showing a species sensitivity distribution, and you can see that the answers change dramatically if you consider count or mass of the particles as the determinant of toxicity. And so we came up with a more data-driven and mechanistic-driven approach to deal with this complexity issue. It's called an effect-based alignment using ecologically relevant metrics. And what we mean by ecologically relevant metrics is that there are certain particle traits that are associated with the actual impact that we observe in these organisms. Food dilution, as I mentioned before, can be well predicted by the volume of the particle because that's really the thing that we care about. And we can have to consider the particles that can actually be ingested by each individual organism. We also consider tissue translocation mediated effects, like I mentioned earlier, like oxidative stress and inflammation. And for these effects, the surface area of the particles are good predictors of those toxicities. And we have to really only consider the translocatable sizes, which are pretty well conserved across organisms, including humans. So, to give you an understanding of how we do this in practice, I'm going to walk you through the simplest example, which is imagine an effect threshold in a laboratory where they expose an organism to 4 particles per liter. We then calculate the translocatable surface area of those 4 particles or the volume. And then we can take that area and then compare that to how many translocatable environmental particles would have that same surface area, while that diversity is defined via realistic distributions. So if we're dealing with a specific type of microplastic loading in an environment that is biased towards microfibers or fragments, the answer may be 12 particles per liter or 3. The answer will change depending on each individual environment and those distributions of particles. The basis for the ecologically relevant metrics has been evaluated through critical reviews looking at studies that determine the mechanisms of toxicity in individual hazard studies. And in 2020, it was determined that there was a high weight of evidence for food dilution causing effects in numerous organisms. We've known this qualitatively for a very long time. This is a picture taken from 1969 in Hawaii, in which researchers walked across a beach and found Laysan albatross. You could see the plastic in their guts. And 90 out of 91 of these Laysan albatross had observable plastic in their guts. So we know organisms eat plastic. We know some of these organisms are literally starving based on the plastic that's in their guts. So it's a very easy to understand and well-validated mechanism. When it comes to dealing or understanding the bioaccessibility, as I mentioned before, we have to restrict this to each individual species, as some organisms are going to effectively ignore certain plastic particles because they literally can't fit them in their mouths. And so we have to create a distribution of bioaccessible particles that fits each individual organism. There's models that are available to do this. They're fairly well validated. We depend on a 2020 study that provided a model that uses animal body length to predict the longest ingested plastic for different organisms. And then we perform a series of relatively complicated mathematical transformations in order to convert these environmental microplastics to the monodispersed lab study hazard data that we have. And this looks like a lot. We have simplified the application of this through R packages that I've developed with my team so that people don't have to necessarily understand all the ins and outs of this relatively complex modeling exercise. So I'm going to show you how we've applied this to the systematic literature review obtained data that my team has conducted. This is an updated assessment that I just published earlier this year. We now have 287 aquatic ecological toxicity studies with 168 species represented, with nearly 13,000 individual data points. We want to make sure that we're using the best of the best. And so we screen these studies for experimental design, particle characterization, and risk assessment applicability, quality assurance, and quality control criteria developed by our expert work group. This whittles the studies down to 58, with 44 species represented and nearly 400 data points. We then perform these mathematical transformations for food dilution and tissue translocation, ecologically relevant metrics, and then perform what's called probabilistic species sensitivity distribution modeling. You may be familiar with the species sensitivity distribution model. This is used by the US EPA as well as the State Water Board to develop water quality objectives. It's been in practice since approximately the 1970s, and is widely considered one of the standard approaches to deriving a hazard concentration for an ecosystem. It's effectively a dose response curve where you have the most sensitive species on one end and the least on the other, and then you build a distribution or you simulate a model to fit the data. We typically choose the fifth percentile of species here to set our water quality objective. That's the EPA's protocol. We iterated upon this approach, and I, together with my team, created a probabilistic species sensitivity distribution plus plus. This is a bespoke application to microplastics that considers the uncertainty involved in these alignments, as well as the uncertainty between individual studies for an individual organism. So, in contrast to a species sensitivity distribution, which fits a theoretical distribution to data, we don't. The probabilistic species sensitivity distribution, we don't assume that there's a theoretical distribution that can be fit to the data. We don't collapse each data. We preserve the uncertainty between the intra and interlaboratory variation for each species, which makes this far more robust to small data sets. It's more representative of the actual underlying data. And most importantly, it actually represents the uncertainty within the assessment. So this, for the first time, gives us the ability to understand how certain we are with our hazard characterizations, specifically taking into account the alignments. And this is a way of visualizing what the uncertainty looks like, comparing a species sensitivity distribution approach with the probabilistic species sensitivity distribution plus plus in pink here. We have a much more robust understanding of what this uncertainty looks like. We can then iterate and build these distributions for marine and freshwater ecosystems, for food dilution and tissue translocation. This gives us hazard concentrations that we can then apply to monitoring data obtained from those environments. I mentioned before, I've simplified the application of this by developing an R package. This is open source and available on GitHub, allowing researchers to quickly pick this up without having to recreate all of the mathematical formula involved. So I'll show you how an earlier version of this has been applied to monitoring data obtained from San Francisco Bay and the interpretation of this data by the State Water Board. In 2020 to 2021, Five Gyres, a nonprofit in collaboration with San Francisco Estuary Institute and the University of Toronto, conducted manta trawl sampling as well as grab samples for microplastics in the San Francisco Bay at different locations, as well as just outside of the bay. In order to assess the risks of these, the obtained data, we first had to consider that the particles that were monitored by the team are not identical to the particle sizes that we have in our hazard database, and we needed to do what's called rescaling. This is a size distribution of microplastics in an aquatic environment. On the y-axis is the abundance, and the x-axis is the particle size. And so you can see here, as we get smaller in size, we get exponentially more microplastic particles. They fragment and they proliferate. And our team was only looking at a specific size range, shown in blue here, based on FTIR and Raman lower size limits, as well as the mantitrol mesh net size, which, if we were to understand the full distribution and estimate what they would have found if they went down to a 1 micron, we would get a better idea for how much is actually in the bay. So there are some assumptions involved with this, uncertainties involved in the modeling, and so we had to do a lot of data cleanup and corrections in order to match the monitoring data with our hazard data set. And I won't go into too much detail here, but in effect, the aligning and rescaling changes the math here so that we're no longer comparing apples to oranges. We're comparing something that's closer to apples to apples with a good deal of uncertainty involved. We applied a four-tier risk assessment profile to this risk character, to the environmental occurrence data using our hazard thresholds. And what's shown here is the exceedances for these different samples within the bay. Green is below all thresholds. And you can see here, out in the open ocean, most of these samples were clear, very low concentrations of microplastics that do not indicate that there's risk to aquatic organisms. Whereas within the San Francisco Bay, and especially in the southern part of the bay, you can see that there are much higher exceedances of these additional thresholds. What's not shown in that map is the uncertainty associated with each of those characterizations, which we characterize quantitatively using probabilistic modeling. When we look at the uncertainty, we see that anywhere between 25% to 100% of samples actually are exceeding our conservative threshold one. And when it comes to the higher tier thresholds, we have anywhere between 5% and up to about 60% exceedances. So a lot of uncertainty with that assessment. The monitoring data is imperfect because it's not reaching our lower size limit that we have hazard data for. We had to do a lot of corrections. And so what did the State Water Board do with this? Back in 2024, they decided to list San Francisco Bay water bodies as category three on their integrated report. And what this means is that this is not a 303D listing. It's a 305B category three listing, which indicates that there's not enough information to determine beneficial use support, but there is information that indicates beneficial uses may be threatened. So effectively, this is a soft characterization that promotes additional monitoring without the need to list the water body for development of a TMDL by the EPA. This report was accepted and approved by the EPA, making this the first water body in the United States to be listed under the Clean Water Act for microplastics in any regard. So one of the main reasons that the State Water Board did not recommend putting this on a higher listing on the 305B or 303D list is that the occurrence data was imperfect, but we also don't have, or at the time, we did not have very high confidence in the hazard thresholds themselves. The expert work group determined that our threshold framework is robust and will likely not change much in the future, but the actual data underlying those thresholds ranged from very low certainty to mid certainty, depending on the expert. And importantly, that database has been significantly updated since then. We've added over 125 studies. We've applied this more updated model. And so we had only about 120 studies for that original assessment. We now have nearly 300. So another topic that I want to talk about a little bit is source fingerprinting. And this really gets at what do we do once we have an exceedance, or what do we do once we determine that there is an ecological issue? We want to determine where those particles are coming from. And I've been working with a team out of Toronto, California, Dr. Roxana Searing's lab, to develop a chemical fingerprinting approach. And effectively what this does is we source store-bought plastics that we know are going to end up in the environment. We can identify them. We know exactly the manufacturer, the polymer type, yada, yada. We also take some samples from the environment that we think are degraded versions of those products. These may be identifiable products, but in most cases, these are going to be microplastic particles because that's what we care about. And what we did was we ran each of these through a leaching protocol. So we expose them to a harsh solvent, and then we run that through a number of analytical techniques like liquid chromatography, mass spectrometry, gas chromatography, mass spec, and many others. And in order to do, we applied this specifically for California. And so what I did with some collaboration at this state water board is that we took all of the beach cleanup data that we had available from 1988 to 2021, and we looked to see which products are ending up on California's beaches the most. And food wrappers and containers have been in the top 10 rank 30 out of 30 years. They are extremely high abundance. This is mostly what we're seeing on our beaches. It's a lot of cutlery, as well as cigarettes, straws, bags. And so we really wanted to focus on these items because this is likely what is turning into microplastics in these beaches. And so what I did was I went to a number of stores and bought a diversity of these different types of highly observed product types, sent these pristine products across the continent over to Toronto, and they ran each of these through their analytical workflow. What they did was a higher order data collapsing. So they took the many different hits that they got from LCMS, GCMS, time of flight, these different instrumentation, and they collapsed them onto a higher dimensional plane. And then what you can do is you can compare the additives that are leaching from these and see if there are any overlaps and see, and most importantly, if you can distinguish a product from another based solely on their unique chemical fingerprints. This is shown for Mylar balloon versus a polystyrene plastic lighter. They look very, very different in their spectral signatures. And when we wanted to get more quantitative with it, we applied a fairly complicated, as you can see, machine learning approach to this collapse of seven different types of data. And what this gives us is a model that can predict with high accuracy what product a particle degraded from. Using a combination of HPLC, QTOF, mass spec with ICP, MS-MS, and the downstream random forest classifier, we can determine with 90% accuracy what product a chemical degraded from. This enables, obviously, an understanding of the source of these particles. And we're what we should really focus on for management. But this also gives us an opportunity to determine with some certainty which manufacturers are actually making these products, which could come into play for some of the Department of Justice's lawsuits against big plastic. And so I want to thank my many, many collaborators that helped me for the data analysis, systematic literature review. This is a Tomex 2 team that is an international group that stepped up to help with this team, this work. And it's just some of the collaborators that contributed to what I showed you today. So happy to answer questions. And again, I'm really glad to be here.
Thank you for the very informative presentation, Dr. Coffin. Do we have any questions? Director Wolf, please.
Good morning. Thank you for your presentation. And you know, one observation, I'm glad to see that you developed what looks like an open source software to perform a fairly tedious mathematical modeling, which from the glance of it included Laplace transformer, Fourier series, that kind of brings a lot of math back to my memory. But My question is associated with ingestible microplastics and microfibers associated with the toxicology effects, meaning the ingestion of these microplastics. And what it made me think of the food chain example of the past associated with PCBs, which have an affinity for fatty tissues. In fact, many toxins do. So when we're looking at that, very simply stated, you know, the little fish is eaten by a bigger fish, each of whom contain a certain amount of microplastics and microfibers. And then ultimately, let's say this ends in the human food chain. So can you speak about, you know, the compounding effect? Because, you know, we're looking at the analyses associated with, you know, the type of fibers, how it gets passed into the marine life, and then ultimately, you know, the human impact. But I'm not clear about this cumulative effect that would take place, because I would assume, let's say, large fish, you know, they do, you know, with their regular, you know, nutrient intake in the water would intake a certain amount of microfibers, microplastic. But then when all of a sudden they ingest another fish, which already has, you know, fair density, I mean, what's happening ultimately? So is this being part of your studies, or do you know where we are with these type of evaluations?
Yeah, those are really great points. By the bioaccumulation factor of microplastics is considered relatively low amongst persistent organic pollutants, especially when in comparison with some of the classic bioaccumulating substances such as PCBs. And the reason for that is twofold. One, the monitoring techniques may not be resolving the sizes of particles that are actually accumulating. Many of these studies are having a very difficult time characterizing the nano-sized plastics, which may be the ones that could actually be bioaccumulating. So there's some data gaps there. And two, we don't see a high accumulation of the small microplastics in many organisms due to natural egestion of these particles. It really depends on the type of organism and how their guts behave. The pictures that I showed you of this Laysan albatross with their guts absolutely full of plastic, that's a relatively unique case, because certain birds can eat things that are much bigger than what they can egest. And so they would have to break the particle down like food, which they're able to do. They can't do for plastic, but before they can egest it. Other organisms can pass the particles through with relative ease. So there is a pretty wide variability when it comes to the bioaccumulation. These particles don't bind to lipids like persistent organic pollutants do. They have more nuanced ways of getting lodged in tissue.
Yeah, because I think, you know, if I recall with some of your other colleagues who were earlier speakers, when we get down to, you know, 1 micron, you know, you start going below to 0.5 micron, that becomes a lot more challenging in being able to size those particles through sampling, but nevertheless, they do get ingested. Thank you.
Absolutely. When it comes to the human exposure to microplastics through seafood, we know absolutely it occurs. And OEHA is intending to use some of that plastic pollution mitigation fund from SB 54 to conduct targeted fish monitoring specifically for subsistence fishermen, as well as indigenous tribes in California. So there should be some forthcoming data for that.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, mentioning it because, you know, certainly, you know, our environmental concern associated with microplastics and microfibers is very important. But you know, ultimately, water quality is also about human being health and potential health hazards. So thank you for these clarifications.
Absolutely. And I'll just add that I focused on the ecological risk characterization work that my team has been doing today, but my current primary focus at OEHA is assessing the human health risks of microplastics through drinking unbottled water. So information on that will be coming out from our office in the next couple of years as well.
Well, thank you for all your good work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Coffin. Any other? We have one more question, please.
Just more of an observation and a kudos to you and your team. I think your emphasis on uncertainty and trying to resolve the levels and degree of uncertainty with the characterization of microplastics is super important. I think there will be a battle going forward with the industry, and it'll be one of the more significant issues they raise is the uncertainty around the effects and to the extent that we can actually direct management toward targeted actions or reductions in source control without more certainty. And so I think what you guys are doing is really critical, that you're kind of pinpointing the uncertainty in some of the methods and characterizations right off the bat. But at the same time, it's not going to resolve it. You know, it's going to always be there. So I appreciate that effort. And I think if there's any more discussion later, I might have some more comments. But thank you very much for your work, Dr. Coffin.
Any other questions? Hearing none, I'd love to thank all five of our presenters. Enlightening and conversation presentations from all. At this time, do we want to take a break, or should we have Mr. Adamo?
Yeah, well, I'd like to thank all the speakers as well for taking the time today. It's very informative. Clearly, it's a topic that is emerging. There's a lot of information that still needs to be figured out. To board member Borja's point, you know, its inputs. Oftentimes, the issues we're dealing with are we don't have any control over what's happening, what's coming into our systems, what's causing the issues, whether it's PFAS, microplastics, or other types of inputs. But certainly, we will continue to follow this with State Board, and there is funding, it looks like, coming in the next 10 years. I don't know how much of that will funnel down to the regional board level, but we'll continue to coordinate with our State Board counterparts. But again, I just wanted to express my appreciation to the speakers today. It was very informative, and thank them for taking the time. And yeah, we can take a break before the next item, I think.
10 minute break. It is 11:03. Let's reconvene at 11:15. Welcome back. It is now 11:15, and we will move on to item number 5, Executive Officer Lodge. Would you introduce that, please?
Yes, thank you, Vice Chair Rodriguez. Item 5 is our update from our State Board liaison. We have our new State Board liaison. I want to welcome Doreen Diadamo, Vice Chair of the State Water Resources Control Board.
Thank you, Mr. Lodge. Thank you, Vice Chair, members of the board. It's good to be back. I was liaison to the board for many years, several years back, and we've had some adjustments with regional boards and liaisons. And so I'm really happy to be back at Region 3. Good to see you all, and I look forward to seeing you in person soon. So I'm going to start off with a big announcement that we just had yesterday. Rollout of the final Bay Delta plan for the Sacramento San Joaquin Bay Delta. This plan has been years in the making. It's taken up quite a bit of our attention at the staff level and also executive management and our entire board. We've had numerous hearings and workshops, and I'm just really excited that we finally have rolled out a final plan. We have a 30-day public comment period, and what this plan does is it modernizes water quality protections for the Sacramento River and the Sacramento and its tributaries and the San Francisco Bay Delta, while also taking into consideration the need for resilient water supplies for the state of California. Nearly 30 million people rely on the Delta for all or some of their water supply. 4 million acres of farmland, and of course, commercial and industrial uses. So it's just a really important resource for the state. I'm really excited that this plan not only uses the best available science, but incorporates adaptive management and a pathway called the Healthy Rivers and Landscapes Pathway. That includes a science program and also a strong regulatory backstop. Public comment closes on September 18th, and our board has scheduled a special 2-day meeting, October 28th and 29th, to consider adoption. We also continue forward on two important petitions that are both before our board, one for the site's reservoir project, and one for the Delta Conveyance Project. Both of those projects are before our administrative hearings office, and our bo entire board is tracking those proceedings, and then we meet often in closed session on those two projects. If you're interested in following the proceedings, there you can watch them on the YouTube live channel. And there are documents that are posted on the web pages for those projects. Now I'll just go through some of the other activities that we've been engaged in during this month so far in August. At our last meeting this week, we held a workshop on a draft statewide general permit for the renewal of the small municipal separate storm sewer system general permit. That permit is currently available for review and comment. Staff has also been holding additional workshops. They held one on the 29th and the 30th of July, and then we just held a workshop day before yesterday. Close of the public comment is September 2nd. And then also at our board meeting this week, we held a public hearing regarding the draft staff report and work plan for the review of our state water quality control plans. So the water quality control plans that we do as a state board, for example, the Oceans Plan, the Inland Surface Water Plan, the Bay Delta Plan, and also looking at the list of many policies and procedures that we adopt as a state board. So looking at applicable water quality standards to help guide priorities for the future for these plans and policies that we work on. Public comments are due by September 1st, and we will be finalizing after that. At our board meeting on Tuesday, we adopted the Drinking Water State Revolving Loan Fund Program Intended Use Plan. This is something that we do every year. Normally, we take up this plan in conjunction with our fund expenditure plan for the Safe Drinking Water Program, which I know your board follows very closely. They're a little bit off track this year. So what we've done is we've adopted the intended use plan for the revolving fund loan program. And then we're going to be following up soon with the fund expenditure plan for the Safe and Affordable Fund for Equity and Resilience. Okay, we were slated to consider at our August 19th meeting, we were slated to consider the utility wildfire general order. This provides for a streamlined permit for electric utility activities statewide that could impact water quality. We've been working very closely with the regional boards on this, and so thank you so much for your engagement in this important issue. At this point, it's postponed likely to our second meeting in September. And then filling in, since what I presume was the last report you received, I don't think you received one in July, so I'll just quickly go through some additional activities that we had in July. We had a public, staff had a public webinar on July 1st regarding alternative compliance pathways to meet the water use efficiency standards that we have for indoor and outdoor standards. And then our board also had an information item on this. This is the Making Conservation a Way of Life program that is fully being implemented at this point. And the information regarding alternative compliance was really intended to assist urban water agencies that are having challenges with meeting the standard as they consider various strategies to meet the standards, including alternative compliance options. So it's really important, I think, for a lot of the urban water suppliers within the region. For anyone that's interested, there's a recording available on the Water Conservation webpage, along with some useful slides that could be of assistance for those seeking alternative compliance. At our July 7th meeting, our board approved a resolution to adopt amendments to the drinking water and wastewater operator certification program fees. Coming up here, we will be adopting, reviewing the annual fees for the various programs, the drinking water program, the water quality program, water rights. And we every year we have several stakeholder meetings so that stakeholders can participate in advance of the adoption hearing. We adopt through an emergency adoption provision, so it goes really quickly once the information comes out in September. But we like to provide these stakeholder meetings as an opportunity to hear from stakeholders about alternative approaches and the information that's available at that time. So in July, we held our stakeholder meetings for these various stakeholder fee meetings, and board consideration for the fees will be September 15th. Okay, once through cooling, our staff has prepared draft determinations and calculated interim mitigation payments for the October 1st, 2023 to September 30th, 2024 operating period for 8 power plants that use ocean waters for once through cooling. Our staff released the draft for public comment on July 27th, and the written comment period ends on August 17th. We had a couple of important announcements in July. One of them on July 21st was the award of additional funds for the successful Tijuana River Trash Boom Project. The original award in 2024 was for $4.6 million, and we saw, you know, real strong success with that program and awarded $2 million additional for that project. In Region 9, San Diego region. And then on July 24th, our board funded through a zero interest clean water SRF loan the buyback of nearly 40,000 acres of ancestral lands in the Klamath River Basin. And this buyback includes a very comprehensive, through the Quartz Valley Indian Reservation, a comprehensive program for water quality non-point sources with the ability to regain the ancestral lands and also to restore critical salmon habitat and protect water quality in the basin. Switching gears here to tribal beneficial uses, we have included tribal beneficial cultural uses in the Bay Delta plan, and I know many of the regional boards are actively working on tribal beneficial uses. On June 17th, Our staff released a really important document that we think will be helpful working in conjunction with the regional boards. This is draft guidance on designating tribal beneficial uses. The guidance document explains the history of TBUs, what they are, how to designate into water quality control plans, and how to engage in the process at the state board and regional boards. The draft guidance does not create any legal requirements or make them more specific. Rather, it's intended to describe existing requirements and practices and to facilitate in the designation process. Our board, on July 22nd, our board held a workshop to gather additional feedback, and there's a public comment period that ends soon on August 31st. And we expect that this document will be an evolving document. It doesn't go through any formal adoption. So, really hoping that as we receive input during this comment period and beyond, that this will be a living document and will improve through time. Stormwater grant program guidelines. The draft Proposition 4 grant program guidelines are available for review and public comment. We conducted a workshop on July 31st, and comments will be accepted until August 24th. And then lastly, just want to announce that we do have applications open for the State Board Safe and Affordable Funding for Equity and Resilience, the SAFER Program Advisory Group. The 2027-2028 term appointments, they're now open, and the deadline to apply is August 31st. There are 12 open seats, so lots of open seats, and the selected applicants will be notified by winter of 2026. Applications are available and accepted in English and Spanish, and you can apply online through email or regular mail. You can visit the program webpage, the SAFER program webpage, for more information. And that's all I have. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much, Board Member D'Adelmo. Do we have any questions from our board?
A question.
Do we have one question here?
Hello, nice to meet you, by the way. Thank you. That was a very thorough update and very helpful for those of us out in the regions. I do have a question, just if you can give us any guidance on what you think the timeline is on the expert panel report for the ag order, given that we are working on that issue, as you know, at this time.
Yes, so we received the expert panel. Gosh, I'm just not remembering exactly. Mr. Lodge might recall the date, but it's been probably about a month and a half, maybe 2 months, since we received an information item. He's nodding your head.
Yes, it's been about a month and a half, I believe.
Yeah, and so we received a presentation from the chair of the expert panel, and at that time, our Chief Deputy Karen Mogus, that oversees the divisions that are working on this in a variety of capacities, she at that point provided sort of an outline as to next steps. First of all, we need to digest, I think all of us, are digesting the expert panel and looking through the recommendations and possible next steps. I know that there's great interest in hearing from regional boards, and I believe, again, Mr. Lodge, you might be able to add to this, but I think what we're looking at is an opportunity to hear from directly from regional boards. One of the things that has been, let's just say, a bit challenging through the process that we've had over the last many years is that once we're in a petition process, it makes it really difficult to talk to people directly. And so we're looking for an opportunity as a state board to engage more directly with regional boards, hear about the water quality challenges, both from you all and also the stakeholders, and, just use this as an opportunity to hear more directly from the regions. And then at that point, looking at next steps and various options that we might have. Ms. Mogis, I think, was very clear. This is not something that's going to go with lightning speed. One of the things that we are looking at from a state board perspective is, do we want to continue the existing process of regional boards adopt, and then if there's a petition that comes to the state board, or do we want to look at some other opportunities for more open dialogue, whether it's through adoption of a policy at the state board or, other informal opportunities, something short of a policy. So I think we're definitely wanting to hear your input and the input of others as to ways that we can improve interaction on this important issue going forward.
Yeah, and we have been engaging with state board staff. Karen Mogis has contacted us in terms of getting our input on that process, but there hasn't been any dates that have been set in terms of when that might happen, potentially late this year, early next year, but it's really up in the air because you can imagine it's a comprehensive process that they have been going through to get the report, and there's a lot of information in that report. I want to make sure that they're thorough in the review, and but they have reached out and are seeking input from the regions.
Thank you, Board Member D'Adamo. We have one more question. Director Wolf.
Yeah, it's not a question. Just want to welcome you back, Dee Dee. And it's been a few years since you were our liaison. Obviously, you haven't lost your touch in providing comprehensive details about updates. So, I personally look forward to have you, being our direct link, and I think the liaison role is a very important one that, as the word implies, is a link between, some of your colleagues in Sacramento and you having a little more intimate knowledge about, key activities and some of the challenges experienced by the region. So thank you for that. And on a general note, similar to Northern California here on the Central Coast, we're about a month ahead in terms of harvests. So, all the local winemakers have purple hands right now. So have a wonderful upcoming weekend.
Well, thank you. It's really good to be back. Good to see you. I look forward to seeing you all in person, and good luck with the harvest.
Thank you so much, and great seeing you.
Thank you.
Moving on to our final item, number 15, the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary update. Director Lodge, or Executive Officer Lodge, if you would please introduce the subject.
Thank you, Vice Chair Rodriguez. Yes, item 15 is an informational item on the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary. We have Melissa Doherty, Senior Environmental Scientist Specialist with the Central Coast Water Board, and she is the Regional Monitoring Coordinator for our office. She also serves as the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program or SWAMP Coordinator and volunteers as the Freshwater Harmful Algal Bloom Coordinator in Region 3. Melissa collaborates closely with the Bay Foundation of Morro Bay and their staff to implement the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program or CCAMP program. She also holds a non-voting government seat on the Sanctuary Advisory Council for the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary. She will introduce a guest speaker to provide an update on the sanctuary this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Lodge, and good afternoon, Vice Chair Rodriguez and members of the board. It's my pleasure to introduce our next guest speaker, Kirsten White. Kirsten is the Resource Protection and Permit Specialist with NOAA's Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary. Kirsten has been staff with the sanctuary since its designation in November of 2024, and prior to that, she was on the sanctuary's designation team. Kirsten handles various duties under the sanctuary's Resource Protection Department, including regulatory matters such as permitting, enforcement, and emergency response. In her role, Kirsten would also be involved in facilitating non-regulatory activities that are focused on safeguarding the sanctuary's qualities, such as water quality-related efforts. And before Kirsten begins her presentation, I would like to make a quick clarification regarding the key distinctions between state and federal marine reserves in California and NOAA National Marine Sanctuaries. So, state and federal marine reserves and conservation areas are more restrictive types of marine protected area zones, whereas national marine sanctuaries are a broader type of marine protected area zones with federal protection and management by NOAA. California Department of Fish and Wildlife enforces the state marine reserves network with support from state and national parks, U.S. Coast Guard, and other local jurisdiction. For example, in our neighboring Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary, the marine reserves network is co-managed with CDFW, Channel Islands National Park, and other scientific and educational institutions. Kirsten will speak more to the sanctuary, to the structure of the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary under NOAA in her discussion. Thanks, Kirsten, for joining us.
While this is getting set up, thank you so much for that introduction, and hello, good morning. For a few more minutes, thank you so much for inviting me here today. I'm really excited to share this update on Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary and what we've been up to over the first year and a half following sanctuary designation, and talking about the core activities that we've been focusing on to build the foundation. I'll start with some background on NOAA and the Office of National Marine Sanctuaries, as well as this sanctuary, including our approach and philosophy that is guiding us in our efforts to build the foundation and stand up this new sanctuary. And then I will dive into an overview of the core categories of activities that we've been focusing on through the lens of the management plan. So you can see here where the Office of National Marine Sanctuaries sits within NOAA, and NOAA is also housed within the Department of Commerce. This map shows the entire National Marine Sanctuary system. Each one of these dots represents one of 18 National Marine Sanctuaries, with the red arrow pointing to Chumash Heritage. Upon designation, it became the 17th sanctuary in the system and the 5th in California. Altogether, the Office of National Marine Sanctuaries is the trustee of over 629,000 square miles of coastal, ocean, and Great Lakes waters. And the primary mission of National Marine Sanctuaries is to protect these special marine places both now and for future generations, while also inspiring momentum for a healthy ocean. Some key priorities within that mission include facilitating public awareness, understanding, and appreciation of these special places, and altogether encouraging stewardship of them, as well as investing in the future by both ensuring long-term protection as well as encouraging uses that are safe and sustainable and respectful, recognizing that people are part of the marine environment. And third, strengthening coastal economies and communities. Now, here's a map of Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary. You can see where it is located here off the coast. The shoreline boundary spans 116 miles between San Luis Obispo County and Santa Barbara County. On the northern end, it starts just north of Port San Luis Harbor down to the Gaviota Coast in Santa Barbara. And it is also quite large. Altogether, it encompasses over 4,500 square miles of coastal and ocean waters, including offshore features like Rodriguez Seamount. And on the right-hand side of the screen are some of the primary goals and purposes of designating the sanctuary. So one defining feature of the sanctuary that I will talk more about in coming slides is our co-stewardship agreement with the Chumash peoples. We are grateful to the Chumash peoples for welcoming us to share the responsibility of caring for these lands and waters, their homelands, since time immemorial. and co-steward the waters with them. In addition to that, the sanctuary was designated to recognize, celebrate, and also increase protection for a whole variety of all of the features that make this area nationally significant and eligible to become a national marine sanctuary in the first place. And so in addition to the marine life and ecological qualities, that also includes the cultural significance, historical and maritime heritage resources such as shipwrecks. And last but not least, a goal of the sanctuary is to guide comprehensive management that is driven by community and ecosystem-based as well as place-based. So as I mentioned, the sanctuary is rooted in our collaborative co-stewardship agreement with the Chumash peoples, centering their voices and knowledge and leadership, as well as us making sure to provide meaningful opportunities to engage or participate in co-stewardship. And so in the first year and a half that we've been building the sanctuary, this means that we've primarily focused on efforts to make sure that we're building this strong and solid foundation that can support co-stewardship and also ensure that we are working within a multi-knowledge-based system, so inclusive of Western science as well as indigenous knowledge. And in addition to that, another principle that is guiding all of the work that we do is leadership through service. So in that, we strive to understand community concerns and be responsive to concerns, values, and goals of the community. And so again, just before diving into the specific actions that we've taken, I'm highlighting this just to outline the philosophy that we are carrying with us and how these have really shaped all of the efforts that we've taken. So it takes a long time to build a national marine sanctuary from scratch. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. And we are especially taking our time, going slow, taking a lot of deliberate intention behind all of the work that we do to make sure that we are upholding these two commitments. And also a through line in all the work that we do at the outset has really focused on building relationships and partnerships. So I say that now just so I don't say it again throughout each of the following action plans that I'm going to talk about. So one of the very early actions that we needed to take are on the operations and administrative side. So establishing an office was one, which we have right down the road on the campus of Cal Poly in the new technology park, as seen here. We also have been assembling and expanding our team. We've welcomed Carolina Behe as our acting superintendent. We have 5 staff currently, primarily to handle key functions and departments. And we are all contractors, so we're not federal employees except for Carolina. And 2 of these positions are short term. In addition to that, this summer we have welcomed 4 amazing interns who might be tuning in online, not sure. And last thing I'll say about our team is that we are geographically spread out. So we range from Central California down to Southern California right now. And one of the major milestones in setting up the sanctuary at the outset was establishing our Sanctuary Advisory Council. And we have had 4 meetings so far, and it's been wonderful to have Melissa as our representative for Water Wards. We really appreciate your participation and how, as you're saying, a link kind of connecting the agencies and building our partnership and opening the lines of communication. It's been wonderful, so thank you very much. Okay, so sanctuaries are designated with management plans, and these documents generally aim to outline a sanctuary's goals, priorities, and basically provide a roadmap on how to achieve those. The Chumash Heritage Management Plan has 12 action plans. However, considering we are working with limited capacity and resources, And also, as a brand new sanctuary starting from scratch, you need to prioritize, especially at the beginning. You can't attack all of them at once. And so the ones that we have focused on during our first year and a half are the ones that are bolded in yellow. And so I'll talk about the remaining four. The previous slide was covering operations and admin. So starting with the Indigenous Cultural Heritage Action Plan, this is kind of the cornerstone of setting up our coast stewardship. And a lot of these elements are interconnected with, again, all of the work that we do and all of the other action plans that I'm going to talk about today. And some key features or highlights of activities that we've done so far in our first year and a half include collaborating with Chumash governments to set up our governance structures, such as the Advisory Council, and also centering Chumash tribally led work, as well as exploring opportunities to collaboratively develop project proposals, which examples of these we'll also talk about in coming slides. So one of these core departments that I was mentioning earlier of a sanctuary is education and outreach. Therefore, the Education and Outreach Action Plan is one that we have been focusing on. Some highlights of progress that we've made on this front include developing our communication forms. So that includes these QR codes, as you can see, to our, they'll take you to our Facebook and Instagram pages, as well as setting up e-newsletters and communication sorts like that to make sure that we are connecting with the sanctuary community. In addition to that, we have made an effort to get out into the community. So, for example, that might look like tabling at outreach events or hosting some sanctuary events of our own, as well as building out our portfolio of outreach materials to take to those events that can help further engage the public. And also, there are two projects that we are working on currently as examples of collaboratively developed projects with the Chumash governments, and those include a series of 12 signs that will be established or installed at various locations along the sanctuary shoreline, and developing a sanctuary poster, which all National Marine Sanctuaries, there's a series of posters, and so we are working on ours. Another core department within sanctuaries is the research department. And so the research and monitoring action plan is another one that we have focused on in our first year and a half. Again, a lot of this work has focused on establishing this foundational framework, making sure that we can support both our coast stewardship structure, as well as ensure that we're working within a multi-knowledge-based system. So two examples of collaboratively developed projects that we have been developing over the past year and a half and are just now starting to set up progress. They received grants for them. This includes a research activities panel and then an Indigenous-led project to develop biocultural indicators. And in addition to that, some progress that we've been made that has been made here is enhancing our baseline understanding of the sanctuary conditions. So looking across to see what monitoring is done, what data is collected, and synthesizing it for the sanctuary area. We've gotten a lot of help with student groups and interns and fellows for this. And last but not least, the final core department of sanctuaries is Resource Protection Department. And within the Resource Protection Action Plan, again, this is my primary area of work, we've needed to make sure that we are able to fulfill our regulatory duties. So that's been my primary focus over the past year and a half, is establishing these programs such as permitting, as well as making sure that we're ready and able and plugged into the systems to respond to emergencies as they pop up, handle enforcement matters and consultations. So again, developing a permitting program, much of that focus, we've needed to address all of the activities that were already permitted before the sanctuary was designated. So much of my work has been going through that process that essentially grandfathers in those permits. And in addition to that, partnership is extremely important in helping us respond to emergencies and carry out enforcement. So a lot of my time has been spent building relationships with our emergency response and enforcement partners. And so stepping back from the Resource Protection Action Plan specifically and looking at that department more broadly, that does include non-regulatory elements too. So non-regulatory activities, initiatives, programs, all designed to protect sanctuary resources, be it wildlife or other qualities and habitats, as well as facilitating stewardship. And so within this, the Water Quality Action Plan kind of resides in the resource protection domain. And so far, we have just recently been able to make very early steps, making progress towards the Water Quality Action Plan. And to do this, we have been able to bring on two summer interns who've really been crucial in kickstarting this action plan. And again, similar to our overall approach, going slow, being very deliberate and intentional, we're taking the same with water quality. So that kind of starts with getting an understanding of the landscape broadly of, in addition to synthesizing, kind of understanding current water quality conditions, we're also looking at the entire network and complex of who is involved and what core actions and maybe programs are all together involved in protecting water quality. And so our focus has been on that in the water quality realm of the sanctuary, all of which will be really important to inform future conversations and planning initiatives moving forward. And with that, that is all. That is all I have for you. So does anyone have any questions?
Thank you, Ms. White, for the presentation, and congratulations on what, a year now, give or take?
Year and a half, yeah.
A year and a half. It's a lot of work that you've done. It's like setting up a new company, basically. And congratulations. We have questions. We'll just start on the right over here.
Thank you. It was really informative. I'm very excited about the sanctuary. I'm just wondering, long-term future, because I've been slow and deliberate, do you envision at some point there will be some kind of a center, a visitor center, an education center, some sort of focal point where people can come and learn about the sanctuary?
That would be great. I think considering that exactly is probably within the management plan and the education and outreach plan. I know that Monterey Bay, for example, right next door, I think it's in San Simeon, there's the Coastal Discovery Center, and it's wonderful when National Marine Sanctuaries are able to have that. So I think eventually it's something that would be considered for sure, but definitely not in the realm of possibility right now.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so thank you for your presentation. And a broader question I have is the role of the National Sanctuary associated with fisheries, specifically subsistence fishing for underrepresented communities, tribal cultural use, one category, the second one, sport fishing, and the third one, commercial fishing. So could you help me a little bit see what's the role, level, and engagement is in those areas?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for your question. One, to clarify, Chumash Heritage does not regulate fishing activities at all. They're looking at the Sanctuary Advisory Council, for example, which the intent is to bring together many different voices and interests and agencies. And so there are seats both for commercial and recreational fisheries. And so with that, the goal is to pull those communities into conversations that have to do with sanctuary management, make sure their voices are heard and represented and engaged in the conversations. Which is a broad answer, but all to say, engagement is there. Also working on building relationships with those communities as well.
Yeah, I asked the question because, yes, I'm aware that, you know, your organization does not have a regulatory role, but when early on conversation we're taking about the sanctuary, you know, there was a certain amount of, should I say, trepidations associated with what some of the consequences were. And so the emphasis here is, you know, collaboration. And I think when we talk about a sanctuary protection of wildlife, which includes marine life, fish, so, you know, that interaction with other agencies, in this sense, NOAA specifically, and then also California, you know, Department of Fish and Wildlife, I would assume that, you know, you do have a active collaborative, you know, conversation. And I ask that because that, you know, I'm sure that was implicit in your presentation, but, you know, I didn't see it to be totally daylighted.
I see. I think that for more, I guess, detailed responses on fisheries, I would probably direct you to speak with Carolina Behe, our acting superintendent, but I appreciate the question.
I'll just add, too, that there are representatives on the Sanctuary Advisory Council from those entities, so State Parks, CDFW, Coast Guard. They are actively engaged as well.
Thank you for that clarification.
Hi, thanks very much for your presentation. It was very helpful. And congratulations on the first year and a half. Could you put up the map of the sanctuary for us once more?
Sure.
I'm just trying to get my geography right. So the it doesn't extend as far as Santa Barbara, Goleta, right? So you're not going to see a big involvement of UC Santa Barbara in this? I mean, they could certainly be involved, but you didn't mention them, and I thought, wow, that's a big resource. But I do know it's outside the shoreline, but how has your interaction been with the UC to date? Have they been engaged at all? Or
Our representative on the Sanctuary Advisory Council was, he's actually currently leaving, unfortunately, but Chris Free was with UC Santa Barbara. So to some extent, there's involvement or engagement. Primary focus, especially by being located on the campus of Cal Poly, is Cal Poly. However, the boundaries don't delineate or define or prevent us from working with anyone who's outside of those boundaries. So to date, beyond more direct conversations and collaboration with our advisory council representative, there haven't really been steps to solidify that relationship with UCSB.
Okay.
Whereas I think a memorandum of agreement is underway with Cal Poly. So different levels of engagement currently, but definitely not, that could change in the future.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. I just, helping me kind of understand the players. You also mentioned tribal governments with a plural. I just wanted to understand what does that involve? Who are the tribal governments? But Chumash has multiple. Could you just describe that a little briefly?
Yes, there are many tribal entities in the area. There's tribal governments, there's tribal indigenous communities. There's San Ynez Band of Chumash Indians is the only federally recognized tribe in the area. However, there are other Chumash and indigenous governments that are organized as governments such as YTT up here. And so we are currently working with four of those Chumash governments.
Okay. Could I go to resources and websites and see kind of all those involved? I'd be interested in seeing that at some point.
Yes. I'm not sure if there's a link on our website, but yes, each of them have their own websites.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. All right, thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. I'll also specify that in the staff report, there is a link to multiple resources on the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary webpage, including the advisory council, so you can see all the different committee members or representatives, both government, non-voting, and public.
We have one more.
Quick follow-up question. So I know that you couldn't fully answer his question, but it didn't remind me that one of your slides talked about regulatory activity, and so now I'm confused. But what can you give me an example of what regulatory activity there is that you're doing or that you're involved with?
Yeah, sure. Our regulations are quite similar to our neighboring sanctuaries, Channel Islands and Monterey Bay. And so while fishing is not one of those regulated activities, generally our regulations focus on preventing specific activities. So there's a list of 11-ish prohibited activities that primarily focus on those that could damage or harm the ecosystem broadly. So one such prohibition is seafloor disturbance as well as discharges into the sanctuary. And otherwise, there's wildlife-focused ones such as attracting a white shark, reiterating protections that already exist for marine mammals, seabirds, sea turtles, and what else is there? There's a prohibition against abandoning a vessel in the sanctuary, as well as leaving harmful matter aboard and new oil and gas development.
Thank you.
So to your point, because yes, I was myself a little nebulous on, you know, the specificity of the role. So hypothetically, that would include submarine fiber optic cable installations.
Any activities that would result in disturbance to the seafloor would be prohibited. So, okay. Yes.
And then if my memory and geography serves me right, when we're looking at Avila and we have this straight line going out, I think that the early proposed offshore windmill farms were in the northern part of the sanctuary. So that was exactly north of it. And hence why also, you know, we have that straight line and those leases were, you know, federal leases were on the northern part, right?
Yes, the proposed boundary initially extended all the way up to southern border of Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, right, in Cambria. So it was over 7,000 square miles, right, of coastal ocean waters originally, and now it's around 4,500 square miles. Yeah. So, and yes, there's that area that is not part of the sanctuary.
Right. That was the carve-out for, you know, potentially the offshore windmill farms.
There were a variety of reasons why the boundary ended up being what it.
I mentioned the windmill farms because that was the one that was a bit more at the forefront of you know, some of the conversations.
Yes.
So last point, another question. And that got into part of a conversation associated actually with the offshore windmills, is the Navy using, you know, some of the areas for exercise, and some of the exercise are a little more than just cruising along the waterways. So what's the interaction in terms of those activities? Because some of them related also to commercial vessels and the impact on the whales, right? You know, accidental injuries of whales in the marine traffic. And then also some of the areas with Navy vessels in exercising the areas. Maybe I'm getting too detailed, but I do remember these were all part of, you know, the big conversation. So any comments on that?
Through our regulatory lens, I can speak to that. Well, as previously mentioned, of course, there's coordination and conversations, especially within the federal government. And when it comes directly to our regulations, there is a broad exemption for Department of Defense activities. However, there's part within the National Marine Sanctuaries Act, there's a specific section that speaks to consultation with other federal agencies. So there's a separate process to coordinate with other federal agencies, so such as Department of Defense.
And then the maritime traffic, because there were conversations with maritime traffic to look at rerouting, you know, some of these path, almost similar to, you know, airlines. They don't just fly anywhere where they want. There are specific highways in the sky, and there are specific highways in the ocean too for, you know, maritime activities. So on that side, for the non-military side, is that something also where, you know, you have these collaborative conversations, some of which were to consider moving some of these, you know, maritime heavy traffic areas away from areas which were known to be, which are known to be, you know, whale migratory paths?
I believe that National Marine Sanctuaries, especially Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary, definitely involved in conversations, although that's not a process that would be carried out by NOAA. And also speaking to the non-regulatory focus of Resource Protection Department generally, with other National Marine Sanctuaries along the West Coast whale conservation, especially through the program Blue Whales, Blue Skies, which is an incentive program for commercial vessels to slow down. I know that that is one of the ways in which this activity or issue is addressed. So I know it's something that sanctuaries track, definitely. For Chumash Heritage, it's not something that we have been involved with, but are tracking, of course.
Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions? Oh.
It's actually just, as I look at the map, I think you just answered it, though, on the Department of Defense, but SpaceX is right smack in the middle of this as well. Is the Department of Defense working on that discussions, collaboration of things that might fall into the, I guess, fall into the area?
Sorry, is Department of Defense working with SpaceX or with
it's
us?
It's just, yeah, like when you have a rocket launch, mm-hmm. It seems as though it's a possibility that there could be some things that end up in the ocean there. In the protected area. So do you know if that's something that's being, I mean, we certainly get questions on, you know, other water quality issues related to that area. Do you know if that's something that's, you know, also in discussions of this, you know, just consultation within Department of Defense?
Also an issue that is being discussed and tracked throughout sanctuaries in the area, so including Chumash Heritage and others.
Channel Islands, yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Doherty. Thank you, Ms. White. We appreciate you being here. It is now 12:09. And before we close out the meeting, I just want to thank everybody that participated, everybody from our AV team to our clerk, our staff, our executive management. Thank you so much for being here, and especially to our board members and presenters and anybody that watched this online, and also to our liaison, Ms. Diadamo. Thank you, everybody. Actually, it's now 12:10. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.